where we are met with cynicism and doubt, and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can. Yes, 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 it's time. We all come together. Ha-ha! Barack Obama!
Yes, we can.
Barack Obama!
We are
Barack Obama! Yeah, yeah, yeah! Barack Obama! Oh! Barack Obama's making history, man. He's coming with a message for the people saying, yes, we can. Sure! Si se puede, today is a new day. So come on and throw your hands up, every woman, every man. Barack Obama.
Yes, we can be.
Barack Obama.
We are ever
Barack Obama. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Barack Obama.
Like a new crowd, a million stops in a new route. This acting out was impossible, still better than the futile. Political change, really complain. All in attempt to rebalance the reign of a power to the people, so that we may develop a sequel. For living in love of a peaceful, pushing the envelope, honoring all of the work. Paying attention to reason, giving up feed and giving the moderate work. Teaching minds of a new height, seeking signs of a new life. This is the meaning of outreach, when it's out of reach, we still
work.
Yes, we can be.
Barack Obama,
we are ever
Barack Obama, yeah, yeah, yeah. Barack Obama, Alexander.
I like to pay respect and love to he who let us know that we can do whatever we dream. Take my hand, let's take this stand. If we say no, you can, you tell us yes, we can. Yes, we can, yes, we can, yes.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to the Galactic Roundtable. I have Marita and Tara and Rama here with me tonight, and we are having our, we are in a 72-hour period leaving the Lion's Gate, and we are approaching no time at zero point, and we have the evidence popping out all over in the news, and we'd like to talk about that first. We have a lot to share with you tonight. Glad you're here.
Get ready for a roller coaster ride, everybody.
Oh, my God.
Oh, Rama, I heard you got a phone call today.
Yeah, I did.
What?
Now, let's just say I was out there playing with my phone and dialing 40 numbers to see who would pop up, and Mr. Rex popped up. And he said, just a minute, and he was gone for about a minute or and a half, maybe 2 minutes, and he showed back up on the phone, and he goes, you'll never guess who I got on the phone, and I just said hello, and I hear this, you know, African-American man just say, hello? And I said, who's this? And he goes, Johnny Randall. And I have not spoken to Charlie Randall since 2002, 2003.
Well, it's 2002 because we were up there at what's his name? Bell ringers.
Yes. And Mr. Randall talked about how this story goes so far back, it's got dog ears and then some. And he said, I'm 80 years old and I've been in this longer than you've been alive, sir, to make sure that you and everybody else in the Aboriginal Washita Moabite Nation get what is coming to them, which is your freedom. And, you know, this goes back to the original story about the farm claims and the black farmers. And this is a long, convoluted, twisted story. And it is huge because what Mr. Rangel brought up this morning to me is, you know, he brought it into the realm where, you know, this guy that I played before, that was on Red Ice Creations, Chris, I can't think of his last name, but The Gods Wear Spandex. And go read that book, because it describes it all. And he said, Mr. Rangel, that how come it is that I am being brought up on ethics charges, and Miss Maxine Waters, who, you know, is the head of the Black Caucus, and she trades places with Barbara Lee, and it goes back and forth, and it's to keep everybody safe. And the way Mr. Rangel put it to me is that it seems to be okay that Larry Summers and Kim Geithner, and even I heard a story today that, you know, Mr. Gibbs, the White House press secretary, and Bernie Madoff, and all of these folks, how come it is, Mr. Rangel said, that these guys can step into the realm of the hedge funds and private banking systems and foundations and trusts and get away with bloody murder? And if a black man on an original Aboriginal Moabite person does this, they are crucified. Mm-hmm. And he said, this is what is going on to me. And I am not going to leave the House Ways and Committee.
And me.
Yes, the House Ways and Means Committee. He said, they are going to have to expel me with tooth and claw. He said, I'm in this for the full fight because I am going to see to it that everyone gets what is coming to them, which is your freedom and the farm claim.
And justice in the case of the perpetrators of prevention of that.
That's right. And he said that right now, Mr. Bernie Madoff is sitting in a prison that is like, let's say, a maximum security prison, and Bruno is sitting with him. Bruno is a four-star Russian general who sold nuclear arms to people like back in the 70s and the 80s, Adnan Khashoggi and Mr. Mohammed Al-Fayed and Mr. Osman, Tim Osman, a.k.a. Osama bin Laden, who is a partner of the Carlyle Group, of which the head is Mr. James Baker. And this is so deep.
And he answers, as always, answers to Bush Sr., because Bush Sr. created the Carlyle Group first in 1988.
Yes.
It was in 1996 when the Carlyle Group manufactured a computer program and called it Al-CIA,
Al-Qaeda. And Mr. Rangel explained to me that what there's a double standard here that goes on, and it's so deep, and it has to do with the games the 13 families play, and that if you're white and you're born into the 13 families, you're covered, and if you're black, forget it, you know, and you have to rise up in the ranks, and it's not who you know, it's who you kill. And he said that this has to end now. It's
the killing, that
the
is.
The killing.
Speaking of killing.
Yes, and Mr. Rangel brought this up in the understanding that what is happening is somewhere between the time Bush Sr. left office and Bill Clinton got in, he shared a little ditty with me, and this involves former Representative Dan Rostenkowski
from Illinois,
who died at 82 today.
He was killed, everybody.
That's right. They said he died peacefully in his home, and I doubt that.
In Wisconsin, his home was, yet he was an Illinois rep.
Right.
From 1969 to 1995, he served in Congress. And then he wielded the gavel as, this is the key, everyone, as the chairman of the
House Ways and Means Committee
for 11 years.
Yes.
From 11 years, I wonder what that 11 years was. Beth, you know that whole sequence.
Yeah, 1981 to 1994. And for people who don't know this, the Committee of Ways and Means is the chief tax writing committee of the United States House of Representatives. Members of the Ways and Means Committee cannot serve on other House committees, though they can apply for a waiver. The committee has jurisdiction over all taxation, tariffs, and other revenue-raising measures, as well as a number of other programs, including Social Security, unemployment benefits, Medicare, child support, temporary assistance, welfare, foster care, and adoption. So for the people who don't know what Ways and Means is, it's taxes.
Yes.
Beth?
Yeah.
This says he was only chairman for 11 years, in 1981 to 1994, is 13 years.
Yeah, it's 13 years.
It says 11 years here.
Oh, this story got it wrong.
Are you sure?
Yeah, it was 13 years.
Huh.
But the important point is that when the farmers' claims were found and they needed to be paid in 1993 and 1994, when the Supreme Court came back and founded for the black farmers and said they need to get paid, Dan Rostenkowski was getting ready to pay them. And then, Rama, you were telling me the story of what happened back then.
Wait, before we go on with this, the name of the farm claim in 1983 is not farm claims. It's called the Bergerbank Farm. And that goes back to Abraham Lincoln. And we talked about this on Lord Jamal's call on Sunday, that Abraham Lincoln was murdered by his wife, who was a colonist. And a
Mary Todd.
Yes, and she was a colonist, and she went to Europe, and she didn't get any of her inheritance if they kept her to keep her life, because she served the Collin family, because Abraham Lincoln, his father was a Rothschild, and his mother was a Moabite slave girl, and they don't say what happened, but you know what goes, yet you know what they do.
Yeah.
These folks, to get what they want, they use him, and he was not a nice man. I'm so sorry, everyone. Although he did things that needed to be done in a good way in terms of the Emancipation Proclamation. He took money from the Moorish people, the Moabite people. I think it was for him, what's that, 35 or 25 million, and that was a point that enabled him to get the victory to pass the law in 1863, yet of the Emancipation Proclamation. Yet the reason that the Collins wanted him dead is because they would never, over their living body, ever give a slave a dime. And
right.
There were two things in the Emancipation Proclamation. Besides declaring that they were equal and free, they were supposed to be given what's called 40 acres and a mule. What that meant is they were supposed to be given some $12 million that were coined by Abraham Lincoln, an amount of money where they could actually be citizens of the soil with their own right to property given as reparation, and that never happened. And of course, you know, the Underground Railroad was really wild after that. Okay,
yeah, and what?
And then they assassinated Burgabane
yes.
in 1985, and then they went to the Jones Trust,
mm-hmm.
and then they assassinated him, and then they went to the Fisher and Taylor, and then they assassinated them. And in 1987, James Gilmore, working for the bankers in Switzerland, in Geneva, he was like a mole. He actually worked for the Charltons. And the Charltons were hired by Mr. Charcoal.
And Mr. Gilmore claimed he was a minister.
Oh, he said he was a minister in Atlanta, right down the street from the Martin Luther King guy.
Oh.
That great guy. And he was just nothing but a
shyster.
He was a money greedy man, and he had the authority over all what we call war chests, which were sent up in the United States all over the country. A war chest is a name, supposedly a legal operation where the person that would open the war chest could collect money, and they could also take the money out. In other words, a free-for-all, so that they could collect money from all of us. And we all went about, you know, all through the 80s and into the 90s. Ministers went ahead and set up their own anyway in the same greedy fashion. As Lord Jamal said, just set up a church, which is really meaning circus, and then invite all the people to come in and pay good money to get infotainment. And that is all they have ever been, everyone.
Yes.
The only true temple is inside. That's the only true temple. And upon this rock I will build my church. That the rock is the rock of Gibraltar in that true statement where the Black Madonna came across the land there. It was the seed of Magdalene and Yeshua as they traveled
from Babylon, where Yeshua's people were being tortured and murdered, and the melanin was taken out of their skin, and the black nobility had that experiment first in order to control, and that's why there were white slaves long, long, long before there were black slaves.
Yes.
Both over in Europe as well as in the United States. And that's a whole other story. And those slaves were called the Black Irish. And the Black Irish were changed the melanin in their skin in Babylon because the Black Irish were of the man with the plan. They were Ethiopians. They were disciples of Jesus. Pat talked.
I was wondering if it's okay with you two, while we're on this important story, I would like to play just a short part of Charlie Rangel's speech yesterday, because it was history making, and a lot of people are at work, and when they come home, they don't catch these things on the TV, and this was a profound speech, and I just want to share a little piece of it here, if that's okay.
Okay, and then I'll continue the cosmic story here.
Awesome. Just a bit. Here we go. Thank you.
To end my career in dignity, he didn't put a time limit on it. And I would think that his concern would be that if any member of the House of Representatives has been accused of serious crimes or allegations, that somehow, within the process, even though we're not entitled to a court process, there has to be some process in which the member has an opportunity to tell his constituents, his family, and his friends what he didn't believe. So when the chairman of the investigative committee said I had been offered a settlement, reminded me of something that I will devote my retiring years to, besides education, which is the major thrust of my attempt here, is that those of you that come anywhere near criminal courts, we have a terrible thing that happens throughout these United States, and that is that someone gets arrested for a very serious crime, and they get their lawyer, and the lawyer explains that, I think it's better that you plead guilty to a lesser crime. And he says, well, I'm not only not guilty, but I don't even know what's involved here. They said, well, listen, we're not suggesting that you plead guilty if you're innocent, but we think you ought to know that this judge, if you found guilty, is going to send you away for 20 years. On the other hand, you have no offenses, you're a first offender, and if you could just forget about this thing and explain later what happens. And so he continues to tell his lawyer that, hey, I'm willing to admit what I've done wrong, and I've done some things wrong, but I shouldn't have to anyway. He says, listen, we would never tell you to quit or resign. We're just ready telling you that it'd be easier for us if this was not an issue. But knowing the president as I do, I think he believes dignity means that everybody is entitled to be judged for allegations against them. Now, what's working against me? We come back to this house because the speaker has called us here in order to make certain that we provide resources for governors and mayors to maintain our teachers and our firefighters, and Rangel's not on the schedule for anything, which is okay, because I know that the members of the committee, they work hard. It's a selfless job. God knows I wouldn't take it. I respect the time that they placed on this. And it's been almost 2 years, but I have a primary that takes place a couple of days before they even thought about meeting. And then I found out from my lawyer that even when they meet on the 13th of September, there is no trial date for then. And so I don't want to be awkward and embarrass anybody. As a matter of fact, that those people that believe that their election is going to be dependent on me resigning, I like to encourage Democrats to believe. I think Republicans have given you enough reason to get reelected, and they continue to do something. But quite frankly, I think I've given. I mean, a lot of people don't know, but I don't want to be critical about this committee because my lawyer said that you can't get annoyed with them because they still may be room for settlement. And I thought about it. And, when I found out that one of the Republicans that will be sitting on what they call the adjudication committee had made remarks to them and me for my contribution to City College, that it was a Rangel thing, an ego thing, and a corrupt thing, and he was going to judge me, I asked my lawyer, I said, well, how can they do that? I said, well, the ethics committee can do what they want. I said, well, do me a favor. I paid close to $2 million. I continue to owe you money. And you're telling me that you have no idea when there's going to be a hearing. And every time I talk with you, there's 6 or 7 lawyers. Say, do me a favor. I said, Friday, let's see what happens today in terms of reaching out to settle this thing because I can't afford to be represented by counsel. Each and every day, the expenses build up. And I think that I have an obligation to younger members of Congress to be able to tell them, if you couldn't raise the $2 million, you're out of business, no matter what the allegations are, because no one's going to read the defense. And, of course, just the allegations by themselves would members of close districts, Republicans or Democrats, they would be out of business. So I'm here because I could afford lawyers for close to 2 years. But everyone would know that it comes to a limit. So I told them, just put everything on hold. See what happens when we meet here. And guess what? Nothing happened. There's no agenda. So what they're saying is that, well, the ethics committee will be leaving for members to be able to work in their districts and to get reelected. And I'm having a primary that I have to wait until after my primary to find out when the ethics committee intends to have a hearing. And then that hearing comes just before maybe the general election. Then there must be something wrong with the rules because people would advise me that I could only hurt myself by coming before this committee. Nobody has tried to protect the integrity of the Congress with almost two years of investigation. They said the mistakes that Rangel has made, it should be public. And it should have been public earlier than now. And I couldn't say anything because I didn't want to offend and don't want to offend the Ethics Committee. But the Ethics Committee won't even tell me when I'm going to have a hearing.
Okay, that's a little flavor of what's going on. It sounds to me like they're doing to the head of the Ways and Means Committee now what they did to Ross Tinkowski back then, because he has it in hand to pay the black farmers. What say you, Rama?
I say that what Mr. Rangel said to me today is that
he isn't going anywhere, and nobody's going to kill him either. That's right.
And the way he put it to me, along with Mr. X, is nobody going nowhere except the Bush-Clinton crime family for what they did. And this goes into Dan Rostenkowski, and it's interesting, 94, 95, 96, Bill Clinton, Hillary. They stole $50 million from the Keating Savings and Loan. Remember Keating Savings and Loan scandal? Mr. John McCain is up to his third eye in this.
Yep. So is Hillary with her Rose Law Firm.
And they went and they killed Sherman Skolnick. Sherman Skolnick was the judge buster in Chicago, Illinois. And they blew his house up, put him in a wheelchair, and then somewhere between 2007, 2008, they pulled the plug on him.
It wasn't that late. It was, let me think, I think that was 2006.
Yeah.
And we got to hear him on the Lenny Bloom show, the last time he ever gave a public talk.
That's
and
right.
And 2 days later, he was dead.
Yes.
And he said right on the show, he thought he was going to make it to the next show.
Right.
And I think it was on a Tuesday when he did that last show, and he thought he was going to make it to the Thursday or Friday show. And he said right at the end of that last show, he said, next time I come on this show, I'm going to tell you all what the dark side does to people that they don't like to have around.
Yes.
And instead, he was dead. So that was a big deal, and he has archives upon archives upon archives of these criminals, all the way back to the P2 Lodge in the Vatican, and the black ops of the Knights of Malta, Blackwater are members of the Knights of Malta. And believe me, they are not a charitable organization as they advertise.
No, the Knights of Columbus, all of these Masonic lodges play one game and then another.
As a matter of fact, JFK Sr. was a member of the Knights of Columbus, and he wanted to tell everybody about the Galactics in 1963.
Yes.
And that's why they killed him. That's the number one reason they killed him. And the number two reason they killed him is he was going to expose the Federal Reserve, and he had already set it up to coin, he had already coined $450 billion from the U.S. Treasury.
With a B.
And he was also going to expose the CIA all the way, as in all CIA dogs. Al-Qaeda?
And there are stories out there. This ties in Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, all the wealthy visionaries that played in Hollywood. This also ties in.
Oh, remember the famous thing for Sammy Davis Jr., the famous act? Mm-hmm. You remember he was dressed all up and he was going, "Here comes the judge! Here comes the judge! Everybody, because here comes the judge." He was telling everybody what did Sir Francis Bacon, who wrote the Shakespearean play, say way back then? Anybody? Beth? Beth, what did he say, Beth?
Sir Francis Bacon, what did he say?
Yeah. In the Shakespearean plays, what did he say?
Oh, kill the lawyers.
There you go, bravo, A plus. Okay.
And Charlie Rangel brought this up today in the sense where he was a friend of JFK Sr. And he didn't talk about him in that way. He brought it up that
he knows JFK is alive, everybody.
And he brought it up in the sense of the story of the Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard, Alan Parsons. This ties in Aleister Crowley. Aleister Crowley was part of this inner circle of all of these folks.
Secret Society Order of the Golden Dawn. And Rama was a doctor at that time, a doctor surgeon.
Yes.
Just like Queen Victoria's grandson. And for a while there, Scotland Yard thought Rama did the killings in the Capitol Hill district, and he got vindicated. And the real one who did it was the Queen Victoria's grandson.
Yes, and Charlie Rangel brought up the fact, all of this with the 13 families and so many members of Congress that are tied all the way up to the elder white dragons that sit on the Rothschild Council in Europe, who no one ever sees. And occasionally you see that guy, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who looks like a full-blooded reptilian, and some of the other life forms. And these recently in the last maybe 3 months. I heard a story about this at the local rock station I go on all the time. There were four hikers or three hikers that were lost in the Superstition Mountains, and they were never found, ever. And the stories that my friend, that if you go and type in the name John Winston, who is John Winston on the internet? John Winston used to work for the agencies, and at a certain point in 1996, he got his gold certificates, and he said, hasta la vista, and disappeared. He went into Mount Shasta and got help from Lord Adama. In the process, though, as leaving the agencies, they made him lose his eye, and Lord Adama gave him a new eye. And they killed his son because John Winston's son exposed the chemtrails and the story about the chemtrail pilots and all of that. And I'm going off topic, but all of this goes back to what Charlie Rangel brought up, that why is it that a black man who is just trying to help his family, or a black woman like Maxine Waters, they get crucified for doing a few hedge funds or a few investments. But Bernie Madoff, oh, well, he can sit there with Bruno, the war criminal, four-star general from Russia, and, you know, he is cared for. Granted, he's sitting in a maximum security prison, but all the people surrounding Bernie Madoff, there are stories up the wazoo that are being told. And Charlie Rangel brought this up, that why is Mr. Geithner, why is Mr. Larry Summers, Bernanke, Paulson, even though he's a hologram, all the other folks from AIG, Fannie Freddie, all the Wall Street, C Street, K Street lobbyists, and Tom Hartman talked about this today. Mr. Gibbs, the press secretary for Obama, in 2004, Mr. Gibbs was paid $1 million to go and take down Howard Dean. If Howard Dean had become president, none of this would have occurred. Howard Dean, if he had become president, this was what was said, that he would have nailed the Bush-Clinton crime family for 9/11. And Mr. Gibbs was paid $1 million to bring down Howard Dean. That is why he never made it in the 2004 election. All of this has to do with our lobbyists who sit on C Street and K Street and Wall Street and create the fake laws that for every member of Congress, there is something like 7 or 8 lobbyists that sit at their coattails going, I got $5,000 for
you.
You
got to talk louder than that, Robin.
I got $5,000 for you, dude. Do you want to put it in a roll? And then you take that $5,000 and you make a $100 million note. Then you go and you put it into another roll and make $300 million on that note. And then $1,000,000,000. And on it goes up into quintillions.
And beyond.
And beyond.
It's so out and off the plate. It's beyond the beyond.
This ties in Mr. C.H. and M.K. and the big O, and I won't say any more. I passed the talking stick.
I have a question that some of our listeners have written in and ask. You talk about taking out, and they want to know, is that genetically they've taken it out, or how is that? They just want to know what you mean when you say that.
Say that again, Marita Robert.
The question is, when you say they took out the melanin out of their skin, what I want to know is, was that, were they genetically modifying them and causing genetically things to change, or how did they do that? What do you mean?
Yes, it was the Anunnaki who did it. And they didn't do it on the ground. They beamed people up onto their ships, Enki and Enlil did, and they did the experiment on the ships. What they did it for is because they knew that with the melanin, it'd be much harder to, you might say, quote-unquote, pull the wool over these ones' eyes. And when they removed the melanin, you might say, it temporarily made them a blank slate, where then they could reprogram them the way they would like.
Yeah.
And that's what they did to the white folks. And those of us who knew more, and we are not human.
No.
And, you know, they say, you know, the dark side's not human in the sense of the light side, when we are from the elder brotherhood and sisterhoods of light. We're not human either. We're galactic in our origins, and we volunteered to come into a human body with our divinity intact with no veil. That's the difference. And the ones that they turned into this white-skinned, meaning a blank slate, they did not have that easily of the memory. They blocked the memory code. And it was going to take galactics who are not human to inhabit the form with the white skin and then know how to produce the melanin in copious amounts at the pineal gland level. And then we could reverse their intentions for the white race.
And there is a story that one time in the X-Files, Scully and Mulder went to a area somewhere, I think it was connected with Area 51, and they actually broke in with the help of, the Deep Throat guy that Mulder used to talk to, and that other black guy when he would put the sign up in the window that he wanted to talk to him, and then he would show up, or Deep Throat would show up, and in this one episode, they went into the X-Files, they went to Area 51. And in Area 51, they had these different laboratories where they had these long cylindrical tubes. And they had amniotic fluid in the cylindrical tubes. And they had gray people in there in hybrid grays, and they also had human hybrid grays, and they also had some reptilian human hybrid grays in there, and they even had some chupacabras in the amniotic fluid. And at a certain point, Scully was looking at the medical records on the clipboards of each one of the amniotic tubes. And Scully said to Mulder, they're extracting the melanin out of these bodies.
That's right.
And what is the melanin? The gold dust, as Dr. Valentine talks about. They're taking their power away.
Taking their power away.
So they become sheeple.
Now, the thing is that on certain levels in Area 51, there are no records.
None.
So if you try to find these experiments at the deeper levels, you'll never find them on record.
Bob Lazar knows all this stuff, and I have no idea where Bob Lazar is at this
point. We'll tell everybody who that person is.
Bob Lazar worked for Area 51, and he
escaped, didn't he?
He escaped, and he started to talk about the advanced propulsion systems and even helped them back engineer one of the advanced Pleiadian craft that they had captured.
Now, there's a good reason, on another note, to the places where they were not having any records, because there was a war going on, right?
Yes.
Primarily between the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds. And the Rockefellers are the ones that did these experiments successfully and did not keep a record. The Rothschilds didn't have the technology because Ashtar after the Rothschilds, and in particular, the DuPonts, everyone.
Yes.
That's Hillary's people. The DuPonts developed all explosives, including and especially those nukes that went down in Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
This is very important, everyone. The Japanese had already surrendered, and they did it anyway. Who did it anyway? The DuPonts, in behalf of the Rothschilds. Remember, Hillary is not just a DuPont. She's a Rothschild, where her true blood grandfather was Hitler in the real form. And so Hitler wanted her family, the DuPonts, to actually do the experimentation of dropping those bombs. So even though Japan had already surrendered, they went and dropped the bombs anyway. Pure experimentation. They wanted to see how much damage they could do.
Tara.
Yes.
So now, as an add-on to Marita's question, I need to explain the melanin more. So They did I call them procedures, you could call them surgery to these people, and they removed the melanin from their skin, and if we look at the science of melanin, we find out that melanin is circulated through the lymphatic system of the body, and there is an uptake process that goes between the lymphatic system and the skin. And so in lighter skin people with lighter complexion have less melanin, and their DNA was involved in the grand experiment. So that means removing some of the gold dust from their bodies, and this made them easier to program. Now, as time has gone on, and we have masses of us are waking up, and our consciousness has raised, there's another, melanin is produced and stored in the body, and it circulates through the lymphatic system and is uptaken into the skin. So people who have a higher consciousness do have a large amount of melanin in their bodies, which is produced and stored in the brain, in the pineal gland and the pituitary gland. And so now, even if someone's complexion is less, it doesn't always mean they have less melanin or less gold dust. It's just stored in the brain. So this healing is happening where these higher levels of melanin are in the body, irregardless of what the complexion looks like. And that's why we have to study the blood to really know what our genealogy is, because the answers of who we are found in the DNA in our blood, not in the color of our skin.
That's right. And I've
heard people talk about that the people with AB are the extraterrestrials. Do you know anything about that?
No, it's a combination of AB and RH negative. It has to be both. And there are ETs in all of the other bloods. Yet these ETs, there's only, in that combination, only 0.04% of these kinds of ETs on the planet. And the others, there's some ETs, yet they're much rarer in the other blood types. And without, you know, and it must be the RH negative in combination.
That's what I have, the AB negative.
Now the thing is, AB, you have AB negative, RH negative, right, Beth?
Right.
Yeah. It doesn't matter whether it's positive or negative in terms of the AB thing. The RH negative is combined with either the positive or the negative AB, and that's what makes the difference. Now, when we were listening to Dan Winter,
mm-hmm.
he said there's a trade-off there. He says that when the RH negative rhesus factor shows up, it means they have less of the compassion and they have more dragon blood, which means that, again, the dragons of the dragon family, and we're going to read that, too, when we get there. Benjamin Fulford has plenty to say about the dragon family today.
Oh, my God. Woo!
Anyway, they have a tendency to be less compassionate, which means as they are intentionally tracking themselves, and especially when they got that melanin removed from their skin, then they're easily programmed to do very evil deeds, and they aren't affected because of the less compassion in their. They can just look upon humans as animals, and they can kill them with pleasure, with no remorse. And so those of us who have chosen to have the dragon blood with the white skin, meaning that we have less compassion, we have a harder road. Yet because we're not the humans that we thought we were, we are only ETs, then when we come into that white skin, Rh-negative dragon blood family, then it's not going to be easy. Remember, that's always, Ashtar said it last Tuesday. He said, no, we did not say this was going to be easy. We said it was going to be the hardest thing ever. Because when we get our dander up, even though we know that we're of the Ashtar Command and that we're the high being, when we get upset, we still have a tendency, we can be as ruthless as the dark side. What does that mean? It means what? Ho-oh-pono-pono, and don't you dare even breathe until you do it first. Because we're so vicious when we get angry that we can kill. Mm-hmm. And Akhenaten Moses did. Mm-hmm. He got so enraged when he saw a slave being beaten to death by his own people. He did not even hesitate. He killed the man. As a result, Mother said, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven, Moses Akhenaten. You will not. And so we see, and he came over here to the west, remembering what on Sunday was made very clear. That little colony that was cut out of the African northeastern section of Africa, that has never been Egypt in its true sense. This land in the west called the United States. This is Egypt. And that is why along the Rio Grande going down, the Grand Canyon ending up in the Havasupai People's Valley, every single temple along the Nile is replicated to a T in these temples all the way down. There's Sekhmet's Temple. You cannot get in there to try for your life. They have this electrical grid around the outer periphery. And if you try to get in there, you are dead in 30 seconds or less. And there are CIA crawling all over there because they want to do things with that, and they're researching that. They don't want to have anybody else know about it or even perceive the fact that Egypt is right here. And
there's other ways to get in.
I know all about it, and you got to take orders from you know who, baby, better Beth.
The Admiral.
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Or else he'll put you where the sun don't shine.
With a toothbrush.
You sound like you've had lots of experience with that, Rob.
I have.
I have acts that came from where they start up the Mississippi and where they found a lot of golden statues, underground and all of this. And I helped support a fellow that was actually one of these things that he had found. And yes, it's totally, they say, well, why even some of the names of the cities are there are Egyptian as well. So.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of cities called Memphis all over the state. Absolutely. There's a whole bunch of all those different cities. They're duplicated all over the states here.
We have a
I see we have Earl. Excuse me, Beth.
Earl, hi.
Are you there, Earl?
Yo,
yep.
Earl.
I'm here.
There he is. Hi, Earl.
Hi. I was watching CNN, and they were talking about how the Fed is like, right now they're like, oh no, we sort of miscalculated, that we won't be able to, handle, what's going on. They're like, we might go into a double dip recession, but then President Obama signed in this new, bill today for manufacturing and all that, but I don't see that with all that, with his push to increase manufacturing in the United States, will, keep things rolling, you know, like they are.
I'm not completely sure. Beth, did you hear all the way? I had a little bit of trouble.
Earl, who's not going to keep things completely the way they are?
Well, I don't see how with, the Federal Reserve saying now that there is going to be a double dip recession, and President Obama has signed in this new bill for increasing manufacturing in the United States, but I don't see with even that push of with this new bill that will allow the United States to continue to like get itself out. I mean, it takes time to build up, you know, a manufacturing base, you know, with companies and factories and, you know, that all takes time.
This new bill is just a stopgap until, you know, until things change. So that's right. They're not going to be able to.
And let's say this, that there are all kinds of things already set up that people don't know about. And the reason they don't know about it is because they have to do it in underground places in order not to be killed.
Right.
And
right.
Everything is already ready to go. We have so much anti-gravity technology you can't even believe it. And you can see it from World War II when we had the bombers, the B-1 bombers. They have anti-gravity technology right on their wings.
Mm-hmm.
Those little things
that
go back and
forth. They used it to pick out the World Trade Center.
Yep.
Yes, sirree, Bob. So let me say a little more about that, Earl, because something's going to intercept this, which if this could be a time I could read the latest from Benjamin Fulford about the Federal Reserve, and that will answer a lot of your questions. How about that, Earl?
Well, sorry, I would prefer if people get that from the internet. What I want to do is we had one of the most important news stories of the century.
Anyway, I passed the rainbow talking stick, and I did get that Benjamin Fulford thing in my email, so I'll go read it later.
Okay, good, Earl. Thank you.
Bless you.
Tara, there's, you know, I know you guys want to share Stephen Greer, and I think that's really important. I want to stay on schedule, and I need to share this speech that was given by Secretary of Defense Robert Gates came and he gave a speech saying he is cutting $100 billion from the Pentagon budget. And this ties into no dates, no nukes, no flukes. And right, and they only broadcast this on C-SPAN, and it was on CNN, but it was interrupted by the president's speech, and literally nobody got to hear this. That's how important this is. They put it out into the public, and they completely buried it. They haven't mentioned it on radio. They haven't mentioned it on. They've never mentioned it again, and it's very important that we witness this important speech. And then it's about 48 minutes, and that will give us time for an episode of Stephen Greer. Is that okay?
A-okay.
Okay, everybody. This is a shocking and moving speech. This is about War No More. Rama, do you have anything to add before I start to speak? I don't know if you are breaking up, but I can't hear you saying anything.
Oh, Beth, you're breaking up a lot. And so I'm concerned about you playing the speech until that's cleared up.
I'm sorry. It may be on your end. BBS is saying everything's okie dokie.
Okay, okie dokie.
I hear Beth okay as well, so.
Okay.
Rama, what I had said was, did you have anything to add regarding Robert Gates' speech?
I asked Mr. X about this morning with Mr. Rangel, and Mr. X just said, you have to understand that what this has to do with is that Mr. Gates is doing the right thing, yet it is a bit too little too late because, as everyone recalls, Mr. Gates took the place of Mr. Rummy, who is a war criminal, unindicted to this day, yet he can't seem to set foot off the U.S. turf. And Bush appointed Mr. Gates and Obama kept him.
Only because he needs to be exposed, everybody.
That's right. And it goes back to the fact all of these folks did 9/11. Congress never declared war, and they invaded Afghanistan, blamed it on Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and then Iraq. And Iraq and Afghanistan had nothing to do with 9/11. I repeat, nothing to do with 9/11.
Except that they were really CIA.
Yes, and to this day, there are 78,000 plus people dead.
Oh, it went up higher.
That's right. Mr. X said, that's right, today. And there are still body parts on the tops of roofs in New York City, Manhattan, and they are complaining about a mosque being built on Ground Zero. And
it's not right on Ground Zero. It's
no.
Just down from Ground Zero.
And complaining about the fact that they don't want to have, you know, the fake so-called trials for the 9/11 people.
Also, this gave an opportunity today for Chris Matthews, Congressman Wiener, came on.
Yeah.
And he laid it out that it's unconstitutional and immoral for a senator or a congressman to engage in this debate. They have no business sticking their nose into it. And see how this works. You know, these guys, it's very good.
Okay, Rama, so when you say it's too little too late, I don't want people to misunderstand. You're saying that Gates can't save himself. He's facing Mother Sekhmet. But regarding, you know, cutting the $100 billion, Mr. X and Charlie Rangel say about that?
They said that, yes, this it has to do with War No More.
Right, and that's why I want all of us to listen to this now. Thank you.
Yes.
A few of you saw this. This happened in the middle of the day yesterday. And when I saw this, I was running around the room. I was so excited. This is war no more. This is, you're watching the beginning of the end. Here we go.
Good afternoon. As you know, for the better part of 2 years, the leadership of this department has been working on reforming the way Pentagon does business. These efforts have been spurred by a number of realities. First, our country is still fighting two wars, confronts ongoing terrorist threats around the globe, and faces other major powers investing heavily in their military. It is important that we not repeat the mistakes of the past, where tough economic times, where the winding down of a military campaign leads to steep and unwise reductions in defense. The current and planned defense budgets, which project modest but steady growth, represent the minimum level of spending necessary to sustain a military at war, and to protect our interests and future capabilities in a dangerous and unstable world. Having said that, we must be mindful of the difficult economic and fiscal situation facing our nation. As a matter of principle and political reality, the Department of Defense cannot expect America's elected representatives to approve budget increases each year unless we are doing a good job, indeed everything possible, to make every dollar count. As a first step, last year we began reforming the Department's approach to military acquisition, curtailing or canceling about 20 troubled or excess programs, programs that if pursued to completion would have cost more than $300 billion. Additional program savings have been recommended in the budget we submitted this year. However, it is clear to me that additional major changes are needed, consistent with the reform agenda laid out by the President. I believe that sustaining the current force structure and making needed investments in modernization will require annual real growth of 2 to 3%, which is 1 to 2% above current top-line budget projections. Therefore, in order to preclude reductions in military capabilities that America needs today and those required for the future, that spending difference will need to be made up elsewhere in the department. As a result, in May, I called on the Pentagon to take a hard and unsparing look at how the department is staffed, organized, and operated. I concluded that our headquarters and support bureaucracies, military and civilian alike, have swelled to cumbersome and top-heavy proportions, grown over-reliant on contractors, and grown accustomed to operating with little consideration to cost. This manifested itself over the past decade in vast increases in spending and staffs, by nearly 1,000 employees in the case of the Office of Secretary of Defense alone, and in the proliferation of new organizations and senior executives to lead them. This expansion and its associated habits and attitudes was abetted by a near doubling of the defense-based budget since 2001, and further enabled by a steady diet of supplemental war appropriations, both factors that will soon end. Let me be clear. The task before us is not to reduce the department's top-line budget. Rather, it is significantly to reduce its excess overhead costs and apply the savings to force structure and modernization. Toward this end, starting in June, we embarked on a four-track approach to move America's defense institutions toward a more efficient, effective, and cost-conscious way of doing business. First and most significantly, earlier this year, the military services were assigned the task of finding more than $100 billion in overhead savings over the next 5 years. Unlike budget-cutting efforts of the past, the services will be able to keep the savings they generate to reinvest in higher priority warfighting needs and modernization programs. This exercise is well underway as the services are evaluating their programs and activities to identify what remains a critical priority and what is no longer affordable. They are all planning to eliminate headquarters that are no longer needed and reduce the size of the staffs they retain. I've also authorized each of the military departments to consider consolidation or closure of excess bases and other facilities where appropriate. This is obviously a politically fraught topic. Currently, Congress has placed legal constraints on DOD's ability to close installations. But hard is not impossible, and I hope Congress will work with us to reduce unnecessary costs in this part of the defense enterprise. Second, we are seeking ideas, suggestions, and proposals from outside normal official channels. This includes soliciting input from experts such as think tanks, industry, and the department's external boards. Within the department, we're launching an online contest for the purpose of soliciting and rewarding creative ideas to save money and use resources more effectively. And I would encourage all DOD employees to visit defense.gov on the web to learn more. Third, I directed a series of assessments of how this department is organized and operated to inform the FY 2012 budget request. As part of that process, Undersecretary of Defense Ashton Carter has launched an initiative to improve efficiency and reduce costs in the contracting or goal being to get better buying power for the taxpayer and warfighter in defense goods and services. We plan on providing more details after September, and our intent is for this initiative to begin affecting ongoing programs immediately. Fourth, even with these DOD-wide efforts underway, I have concluded there are a number of areas where we can take action starting now and not wait for the normal budgeting and program process. Therefore, today I am announcing an initial set of decisions designed to reduce duplication, overhead, and excess in the defense enterprise, and over time instill a culture of savings and restraint in this department. These initiatives vary in size and levels of savings achieved, ranging from personnel and paperwork to organizational structures and business practices. They represent an initial step of a comprehensive department-wide efficiency and savings campaign that will be incorporated more fully into the FY12 budget request. I'll summarize them briefly and take some of your questions. Copies of this, so y'all don't get writer's cramp, copies of this statement will be available at the end of the session. And General Cartwright, Christine Fox, and Bob Hale will brief in more detail and answer further questions. So to the initiatives. First, over the last decade, this department has seen a dramatic increase in the use of service support and advisory contractors of all kinds. From 26% of the total DOD workforce cost in 2000 to 39% a year ago, not counting contractors supporting the war effort in Iraq and Afghanistan. In some cases, contractors may be performing functions that should be done by full-time government employees, including managing other contractors. Last year, the department announced a plan to reduce the number of service support contractors by about 33,000 by 2015, and where necessary, to insource those positions with full-time government employees. Based on the data available after 1 year, I'm not satisfied with the progress made to reduce our over-reliance on contractors. Accordingly, to accelerate this process and achieve additional savings, I have directed that we reduce funding for service support contractors by 10% a year for each of the next 3 years. Furthermore, as I'll explain in a moment, we will no longer automatically replace departing contractors with full-time personnel. Second, and directly related to contractors, is the issue of the dramatic growth in size and expense in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the defense agencies, and the combatant command staffs. Much of this growth came from new missions that emerged since September 11th. However, there was no commensurate decrease for activities that had become less relevant and urgent. With additional funds made available, there was not much incentive to do so. As I've said before, the department must start setting priorities, making real trade-offs, and separating appetites from real requirements. Constraining the personnel available is one way to force this painful but necessary process to take place. Therefore, I'm directing a freeze on the number of OSD, defense agency, and combatant command positions at the FY10 levels for the next 3 years. With regard to insourcing, other than changes planned for FY10, no more full-time positions in these organizations will be created after this fiscal year to replace contractors. Some exceptions can be made for critical areas such as the acquisition workforce. These measures are just the first step of a comprehensive re-baselining of OSD, defense agency, and combatant command staffing and organizations. We will conduct a clean sheet review to determine what our people should be doing, where, and at what level of rank, in keeping with the department's most critical priorities. I expect the results of this effort by November 15th of this year. Third, the proliferation of new staff and more layers of bureaucracy is a natural consequence of a substantial increase in the most senior leadership. General and flag officers, career senior executives, and political appointees requiring Senate confirmation. Over the past decade, the department has added to what was already a high historical baseline for senior personnel. For example, since September 2001, the number of general and flag officers has grown by more than 100, including now 40 four-star positions. And the number of senior civilian executive positions has increased by more than 300. As a result of the wars, this department has taken on new missions and responsibilities that have required some of these new senior military and civilian billets. But apart from meeting these genuine war-related needs, we have also seen an acceleration of what Senator John Glenn more than 20 years ago called brass creep, a situation where personnel of higher and higher rank are assigned to do things that could reasonably be handled by personnel of lower rank. In some cases, this creep is fueled by the desire to increase bureaucratic clout or prestige of a particular service, function, or region, rather than reflecting the scope and duties of the job itself. And in a post-9/11 era, when more and more responsibility, including decisions with strategic consequences, is being exercised by more junior officers in theater, the Defense Department continues to maintain a top-heavy hierarchy that more reflects 20th century protocols than 21st century realities. For example, unlike most other commands, four-star service component headquarters remain in Europe long after the end of the Cold War and long after the vast majority of their fighting forces have departed. We need to create a system of fewer, flatter, and more agile and responsive structures where reductions in rank at the top create a virtuous cascading downward and outward. In addition to the number of senior positions, there is also the question of their allocation and whether our distribution of rank by geography or function reflects the missions and realities our military faces today. Therefore, I am directing a freeze at FY10 levels on the number of civilian senior executive, general and flag officer, and PAS positions. Furthermore, a senior task force will assess the number and location of senior positions, be they of old or new vintage, as well as the overhead and accoutrements that go with them. I expect the results of this effort by November 1st. At a minimum, I expect this effort to recommend cutting at least 50 general and flag officer positions and 150 senior civilian executive positions over the next 2 years. These reductions would represent 50% of the total growth in senior military and civilian positions since 2000. That's the minimum. Fourth, there are great benefits to be gained in cost and efficiency from taking advantage of economies of scale. The problem is that too many parts of the department, especially in the information technology arena, cling to separate infrastructure and processes. All of our bases, operational headquarters, and defense agencies have their own IT infrastructures, processes, and applicationware. This decentralization approach results in large cumulative costs and a patchwork of capabilities that create cyber vulnerabilities and limit our ability to capitalize on the promise of information technology. Therefore, I'm directing an effort to consolidate these assets to take advantage of the department's significant economies of scale, thereby creating savings in acquisition, sustainment, and manpower costs. This action will allow the increased use by the department of common functions and improve our ability to defend defense networks against growing cyber threats. Fifth, this department is awash in taskings for reports and studies. In 1970, the Pentagon produced a total of 37 reports for the Congress, a number that topped off at more than 700 reports in last year's cycle. Consider that as of 2009, the department had nearly 1,000 contractors working in some capacity producing reports for the Congress, of which more than 200 were working full-time. Reports directed by the Congress are effectively beyond our control. But a good number of these reports are also internally generated, including by my own office. At this time, nobody knows what they cost, and thus there is little basis to determine whether the value gained is worth the considerable time and resources expended. Therefore, I have directed that starting now, we'll freeze the overall number of DOD-required oversight reports. We'll immediately cut the dollars allocated to advisory studies by 25%. And henceforth, we will publish the actual cost of the preparation of each report and study prepared by the DOD in the front of each document. By October 1st, we will conduct a comprehensive review of all oversight reports and use the results to reduce the volume generated internally. In addition, we will engage the Congress on ways to meet their needs while working together to reduce the number of reports. Sixth, the Department has set up numerous outside boards and commissions, 65 in the case of OSD alone, to oversee our activities and provide independent advice. Some of these entities provide real value, others less so. Even if their members are unpaid, these bodies still require substantial support, $75 million for OSD alone, in the form of staff and indirect costs. Therefore, I'm ordering a review of all outside boards and commissions for the purpose of eliminating those that are no longer needed, focusing the efforts of those that continue to be relevant, and cutting the overall funding available for studies tasked by the remaining boards and commissions by 25% in FY11. Seventh, it's no great secret that since September 11th, the U.S. government has seen a proliferation in new intelligence organizations and operations. This is partly due to the war on terrorism and partly due to massive intelligence requirements associated with fighting two wars. Even so, in the defense arena, large and well-staffed intelligence structures now exist in the services, the defense agencies, the combatant commands, and in the war theaters. To some extent, we're still struggling to find the right balance between the value of centralizing intelligence functions versus distributing or embedding them closer to the point, to the front. Nonetheless, we should not flinch from eliminating unnecessary redundancy and directing more resources to places where they are needed, such as certain specialties in short supply and theater. I'm thus directing an immediate 10% reduction in funding for intelligence advisory and assistance contracts and freezing the number of senior executive positions in defense intelligence organizations. We must also take further steps to end needless duplication within the department's intelligence community. Accordingly, I've directed a zero-based review of the department's intelligence missions, organizations, relationships, and contracts to be completed by November 1st. While these steps will only apply to the Department of Defense intelligence organizations, the new Director of National Intelligence, Jim Clapper, has indicated to me an interest in pursuing a parallel and coordinated effort using the same business rules for the national intelligence organizations. Eighth, the last decade has also seen a significant growth of new offices and organizations, including two new combatant commands and five new defense agencies. So in addition to flattening and trimming structures, we also look to eliminate outright organizations that perform duplicative functions or outlived their original purpose. The Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Networks and Information Integration, or NII, was set up in 2003 when policy, oversight, and advocacy functions for command, control, and communications split off from intelligence. The resulting arrangement for dealing with enterprise IT and hardware issues, which includes a similar function for the J6 on the joint staff, has since become redundant, costly, and cumbersome. Therefore, I have directed the elimination of NII and the J6 organizations. Their operational functions will be assigned to other organizations, and most of their acquisition functions will transfer to AT&L. We will stand up a refashioned and strengthened Chief Information Officer, or CIO, and under its umbrella, responsibility for daily operations will be assigned to the Defense Information Systems Agency. The Business Transformation Agency was formally established in 2006 to foster the reform and modernization of this department's business practices. Since its creation, BTA, an agency that now employs approximately 360 people and spends $340 million a year, has shifted more of its focus to day-to-day oversight of individual acquisition programs, a function that can be performed by a number of other organizations. Furthermore, the mission assigned to BTA has largely been legislatively assigned to other elements of the department. Therefore, I have directed the elimination of the Business Transformation Agency and shifted its responsibilities largely to the Deputy Chief Management Officer. Finally, the Joint Forces Command was originally established to infuse and to some degree compel jointness into everything the military does, especially through training, doctrine development, and the provision of forces for operations. It was understood at the time that JIFCOM created an extra layer in the force management process, but the benefits of improving jointness were deemed to outweigh the resulting extra bureaucracy. Since then, propelled by decades of operational experience, the U.S. military has largely embraced jointness as a matter of culture and practice, although we must always remain vigilant against backsliding on this front. Training joint forces, generating joint forces, creating joint doctrine, and experimenting with that doctrine are all valuable tasks. However, they do not necessarily require a separate four-star combatant command, which in the case of JIFCOM entails about 2,800 military and civilian positions and roughly 3,000 contractors of all kinds at an annual cost of at least $240 million to operate. Therefore, I am recommending the closure of JIFCOM and the assignment of its force management and sourcing functions to the joint staff. JIFCOM's remaining responsibilities will be evaluated, and those determined to be essential and still necessary to protect and promote jointness will be reassigned to other entities. All told, as a result of closing or consolidating these three organizations over the next 6 months to a year, a substantial number of full-time employees will have to find other positions or no longer work for this department. Like millions of Americans affected by this tough economic climate, I know these changes will likely mean real hardship for displaced employees and their families. Accordingly, I've asked Dr. Clifford Stanley, the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, to work with the leaders of the affected organizations to do everything possible to assist their employees in what may be a difficult transition. I do so with great appreciation and admiration for the service these employees have rendered, and with the hope that we can help them find new ways to offer their expertise and experience in service to our nation. The ultimate success of these initiatives, as well as the other reforms underway, in the end will depend on a fundamental change in culture and attitude across our defense institutions. The culture of endless money that has taken hold must be replaced by a culture of savings and restraint. Toward this end, I am directing that any new proposal or initiative, large or small, be it policy, program, or ceremony, come with a cost estimate. That price tag will help us determine whether what we are gaining or hope to gain is really worth the cost, either in dollar terms or in the diversion of limited manpower and resources from other missions. As I've said a number of times, the way to make sure something gets done in this building is to set short deadlines and provide visibility and oversight from the very top. To see these initiatives through from announcement to action, to measurable results over the next 90 to 120 days, I've appointed a task force chaired by my chief of staff. This task force will develop action plans and oversee their implementation and eventual transition to the appropriate department leadership. Taken together, these initiatives, in the context of the four major tracks I described earlier, represent an aggressive effort, not only to reduce costs, but also to reform the culture of this department. This effort will not end this fall or with the FY12 budget submission next February. Instilling habits of restraint, of subtracting as well as adding, of elevating affordability on a par with desirability, is a project of years in the making. This will reflect itself in ways large and small, substantive and symbolic. My hope and expectation is that the efforts we have launched will lead to the kind of cultural changes that over time become a part of the department's DNA and institutional memory. In closing and in summary, I want to reemphasize that this agenda is not about cutting the department's budget. It is about reforming and reshaping priorities to ensure that in tough budgetary and economic times, we can focus defense resources where they belong in America's fighting forces, investment in future capabilities, and most important, on our men and women in uniform. And let me just add before turning to your questions, to see these initiatives in context I think you need to step back and see them as the next move in a process that has been going on for 2 years. It began at the National Defense University with my speech in September of 2008. The far-reaching decisions on programs for fiscal year 10 that were made in April of 2009. The decisions on the alternate engine and C-17s earlier this year. And the Eisenhower Library speech in May. I am determined to change the way this department has done business for a long time. Earlier decisions and the four tracks I've identified are part of a broad campaign that will be ongoing. Today's announcement represents a down payment to demonstrate that I intend to continue to move aggressively to achieve the broad goals of making this department more efficient, but also ensuring that we put our resources where they are the most needed.
Jennifer, you mentioned some of the other big, high-profile cost-saving efforts you've tried over the last couple of years. Given that several of those, including the engine one, you've so far failed to convince Congress that this is the best way to save money, what confidence do you have that Virginia delegation, for example, which stands to lose multiple thousands of jobs and lots of money plus all that real estate, is going to go along with this?
First of all, in April of 2009, most people were deeply skeptical that I would be successful in getting the Congress to go along with a number of the program cancellations and changes that we made, and yet we were successful. Position that I've made clear and to which the president has spoken on the alternate engine and C-17s is also clear. That bill, I'm confident, will be vetoed. Any bill that takes the alternate engine and more C-17s to the president, I am confident, will be vetoed. I think you have to have some perspective here. Just to take the example of the Virginia delegation. If as a result of these efforts, I'm able to add $1 billion or $2 billion to the Navy's shipbuilding program of record, Virginia may well come out with a lot more jobs than it loses. This is why the point needs to be emphasized again and again. This is not about cutting the defense budget. This is about a reallocation internally. And while there will be, the issues are not as clear-cut in terms of people affected as when you're talking about a big acquisition program, I think that the chances for being successful in these efforts are actually very good. I think, for one thing, there are two things that make this different than past efforts. One is this is not a budget cutting exercise. And the second is the services get to keep the savings they identify and invest them in higher priority things. In the past, monies that have been saved have been culled off or have been cut have been culled off. And so they've lost programs. Here they have the opportunity to add to the investments they're making in their highest priorities. So for all these reasons, I think that the Congress and this building, under the current economic circumstances and budgetary pressures, will see this as an opportunity to protect our force modernization and our force structure.
But do you fear, you made some comments.
And I would just say, I talked to the leadership of both the authorizing committees and the appropriations committees. And while I sketched this in broad terms, I did talk about the eliminations and so on. And the people that I've talked to were supportive.
You made some comments earlier that we're worrying against unwise cuts in the defense budget as the United States maybe draws down in Iraq or as we move away from certain conflicts. Is Is that a fear that you have right now? Are you feeling that if these steps aren't taken fully, that there will be pressure to take much more drastic action?
I think that if we are to make a compelling argument for sustaining the top line of the Department of Defense to the Congress, we have to demonstrate a compelling argument that we have, in fact, tackled the things that worry them. Poor acquisition practices, poor business practices, excessive reliance on contractors, waste, abuse. We need to be able to show that we are actually doing something about these programs in a systematic way that affects every part of the department. I think under those circumstances, we have a pretty good opportunity to make our case. But there is my greatest fear is that in economic tough times, that people will see the defense budget as the place to solve the nation's deficit problems, to find money for other parts of the government. My responsibility to the president and to the Congress is to present them with a program that I believe is necessary to defend this nation. And as I look around the world and see a more unstable world, more failed and failing states, countries that are investing heavily in their militaries, as I look at places like Iran and North Korea and elsewhere around the world, as I look at the new kinds of threats emerging from cyber to precision ballistic and cruise missiles and so on, my greatest worry is that we will do to the defense budget what we have done four times before, and that is slash it in an effort to find some kind of a dividend to put the money someplace else. I think that would be disastrous in the world environment we see today and what we're likely to see in the years to come. If you were to graph the defense budget going back the last 40 or 50 years, it would look like the EKG of a fibrillating heart. What we need is modest, sustainable growth over a prolonged period of time that allows us to make sensible investment decisions and not have these giant increases and giant decreases that make efficiency and doing acquisition in a sensible way almost impossible. So my hope is that through all of these efforts, we will make a persuasive case to the Congress and through them to the American people that we are spending tax dollars wisely in the Department of Defense and in areas where they would like to see it spent, and that is in capabilities and in our force structure and investment for the future as well as our troops.
Secretary, you said that you're not happy with the results that you got from the direction you gave last year on the 33,000 contract, cutting 33,000 contractors over 5 years. What makes you think you'll be any more successful in driving through some of the changes you want to make between now and November 1st or in the coming few years?
Well, I think part of the problem was that as we were reducing contractors, we weren't seeing the savings we had hoped from insourcing. And so the way to get at contractors, the problem with contractors is, and what we've learned over the past year, is you really don't get at contractors by cutting people. Because you give a contractor a certain amount of money, and they go hire however many people they think they need to perform that contract. So the only way we've decided that you get at the contractor base is to cut the dollars. And so if you add it up, we're looking at cutting a third of the budget for services and support contracting over the course of the next 3 years. That we are convinced is a way to get a handle on this problem.
About contractors in the war zone. You go to a place like Afghanistan, there are thousands and thousands of contractors. There are 2,000 private contractors training Afghan security forces as opposed to 900 from NATO. And then thousands of other contractors doing jobs that used to reside within the U.S. military. Talk about that as being a problem. With the allies not pulling their weight, and then contractors doing the jobs that used to be done by a soldier.
Well, I think first of all, I think that's kind of mixing things. NATO, our partners have done a lot. And if you had asked me a year ago if we would have nearly 50,000 partner troops in Afghanistan by this summer, I would have thought that a very tall order. So I think they have come through. There are still shortfalls, but the primary shortfall is about 750 trainers, and we're continuing to work on that. Personally, I think that the use of contract, there are a lot of things contractors do that soldiers used to do. Peel potatoes, do the dishes. I think contractors ought to do that stuff. If I've got a highly trained combat infantryman, I don't want him spending his time doing that stuff. And so I think there are a lot of functions that soldiers once performed that should be done by contractors. I think it's sensible, and frankly, in some respects, it's cheaper. So I think that the other aspect of it is, with respect to contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan, is that I see that as a transitory issue. I mean, the number of contractors in Iraq has already come down pretty dramatically. And at some point, we'll see that happen in Afghanistan. What I'm looking at, though, here in this department is a phenomenon that started a long time ago but has accelerated significantly over the last 10 years. That is not a transitory phenomenon, and it's one we need to act to reverse.
Mr. Secretary, you listed some of the threats you see in the world. Which ones do you think you need to address, particularly with some of this money that you hope to free up for what you call priority programs? What are the key things to put the money into?
Well, I think, first of all, the services get to keep, as I said, get to keep the savings they find. My intention is to take the savings that we find from other parts of the department and provide those also to the services. In other words, the defense agencies, OSD and so on, the savings we find there, they don't get to keep. Our intent is to take that money and provide it to the services. I mean, and I used an example earlier. I mean, I think everybody realizes that we probably need more money in shipbuilding. So that would be an area that I would certainly look to when it comes to the Navy, in terms of not only letting them keep the money they identify for that purpose, but perhaps if I could provide some additional resources for them to help them in that area. Each of the services has that in that respect. This is what I am trying, we've had this conversation before. Of the overall procurement budget, and I confess I get a little impatient that everything is about providing for today's wars. Out of the overall procurement budget, about half goes for modernization programs. The Joint Strike Fighter, the new ballistic missile submarine, new ships, the tanker, the next generation long-range strike, this list, the new ground combat vehicle for the Army that they're going to be starting on. So all the services have these modernization programs. And half the procurement budget goes for those modernization programs. About 40% of it goes to dual-purpose things like C-17s that are used in whatever the spectrum of conflict. And only about 10% for the kind of wars we're in. The cost of the wars we're in is fundamentally paid by the overseas contingency operating funds and by supplementals. So this isn't about finding money for the wars we're in today. We've got that money. It's about protecting the money for the future.
So when you talk about reducing intelligence contracts, do you have concerns that the intelligence, that there's redundancy and duplication on the military intelligence side as well as the civilian agencies? Has it grown too large?
Let's just say it's hard for me to believe that in all of these different elements, the services, the defense agencies, the combatant commands and the theater, that there aren't redundancies and duplication. And it has grown by leaps and bounds over the past decade. I read about that in the Washington Post series. But I think the thing that people haven't focused on, and is that that wasn't just about terrorism and the war on terror. A lot of that was the intelligence requirement to fight these wars that were in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think we just need, I don't think anybody stepped back and looked at all of this from sort of soup to nuts in a very long time, if ever. I can't remember it ever being done. And if Jim Clapper does it on the national side, and we do it side by side, I think that there are almost certainly some savings to be found. And what I'm really after are people, and not to fire people, but rather the reverse, to take people who may be doing a redundant job here in the U.S. or at a combatant command, and if we're short that kind of a specialist, intelligence specialist in Afghanistan, to provide, to cover the shortcomings, the shortfalls in staffing in Afghanistan with some of the savings we find in people who are not in theater. But I also think, you know, leaving aside the money and the people, it's just hard for me to imagine in all these big organizations that there isn't a lot of duplication.
You're eliminating the Joint Forces Command. What's going to happen to General Raymond Odierno?
I've talked to Ray, General Odierno, about this. He supports the decision to eliminate GEFCOM. As I indicated in my remarks, I expect that it will take about a year to carry out this change, and I've told Ray that his assignment at GEFCOM has essentially been the same as his assignment in Iraq, and that is to work himself out of a job, and then I'll find a new and better one for him.
Secretary, there's one expense you didn't mention, and that's health care, medical costs. How much longer can you see these growing costs before you really have to pass on those expenses in terms of increased TRICARE premiums or reduced coverage?
Yesterday. Healthcare reform is on my agenda, as is some of these efforts are part of the third track that I was talking about that grew out of the QDR and the other reviews. And so we have studies going on now, as I said, that will help shape our FY12 budget submission. They involve logistics. They involve healthcare and personnel policies, more restructuring and organizational changes, continued acquisition reform. I think it's safe to say that as far as I'm concerned in this effort, there are no sacred cows, and healthcare cannot be accepted from that. Everybody knows that we're being eaten alive by health care. I believe there is a growing understanding on the Hill about this. It cost us $19 billion in 2000 or 2001. It'll cost us over $50 billion in FY11, and it will cost us about $65 billion in FY15. Top line is only growing at 1% or thereabouts. It's unsustainable, and therefore it has to be a part of our effort.
You're not exactly working yourself out of the job by coming up with all these initiatives. Have you made a decision about how long you're going to stay? Because I think publicly you're still only committed to the end of this year.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to stress that that I believe that this isn't just about me, that I believe the service secretaries, the chiefs, Ash Carter, the controller, the director of CAPE, I believe the senior leadership of this department in this administration is committed to all of these activities. Admiral Mullen, General Cartwright, as you'll hear, very supportive. They're doing some things in some respects in the joint staff that are even more far-reaching than some of the things that I've talked about. So I think that there is broad support in the leadership and of course, the deputy who on a day-to-day basis will end up managing this whole thing. So all of the senior leadership of the department from the deputy and the chairman on down is supportive of this. So I have every reason to believe that whenever I leave, that these efforts will continue. The president is committed to it. The Congress is committed to it. So I think a lot of this will continue. As far as I'm concerned, all I will say is that I'm going to be here longer than either I or others. So.
There's probably one or two more.
Mr. Secretary,
these are major changes that you're discussing today. To what extent are they just the tip of the iceberg of what you have planned? Do you see beyond what you're announcing today the need for a further tightening between OSD and the Joint Staff, or looking at eliminating other major commands?
I think that this, as I said at the very end, I think that this is a dynamic process. I expect it to continue. It's not the work of 1 year or of one budget cycle. So I wouldn't necessarily describe it as the tip of the iceberg, but if 90% of an iceberg is underwater, then this is a pretty good percentage of it, but not all. And I expect, you know, as I say, we've got four tracks underway, and I would tell you that the services are thinking about some pretty dramatic things. They're not ready to talk about it. They haven't made any decisions yet, but the kind of options they're looking at are pretty impressive. So I think this will be an ongoing process, and I think we'll learn as we go along. I think as we get into these things, do these zero-based reviews with short deadlines, I think we're going to learn some things that then give us future opportunities or targets or whatever you want to call them. But I think we have to keep after it. Last question. You have it.
Sir, you mentioned reports. I'm just curious about the QDR. The recent report of the QDR independent panels sparked a discussion about the value of it. And it sounds like, even though it's congressionally mandated, it sounds like it's the kind of thing you're describing as maybe to be cost-cutting place to look.
So I actually think that the QDR has value. I think that the outside, and what I told both Bill Perry and Steve Hadley is that I think the outside review of the QDR, if you will, actually would be better before the QDR is written, to have them assess the world and assess the kind of agenda that the QDR looks at, because then it can actually inform the preparation of the QDR with an outside perspective that may allow it to look more broadly at things. Having it come afterward is of limited value because the QDR is already done. It's printed. People are, you know, doing all kinds of things with it. So I think that I think the QDR is one of those that does have value, but I think the outside review would better be done at the front end of the process. Thank you all.
Thank you, everybody. Rama, I sure would like to know why no one on the news has ever mentioned this again.
You only need one time that mouthful, Beth. And you know what was really interesting is that it started on CNN. That's a big white knight leak on CNN.
It sure is. I was stunned. As a matter of fact, my guides told me turn on the news because it was one of the rare times I didn't have the TV on, you know, on mute while I'm working on my computer. And I got onto MSNBC and it was a magazine report about entertainment. And I asked, I said, what are you talking about? And they said, no, turn on CNN. And 2 minutes later, this came on and I got very, very, very excited.
Indeed. And this is interesting because, you know, Mr. Robert Gates is guilty of high treason and war crimes because he, what did he do, Bill Gates?
Robert Gates. He continued the fake wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and escalated the troops in McChrystal and General Petraeus. Wait.
Yeah, they're all guilty of war crimes together.
And this ties in with Hillary, because behind the scenes, the State Department, you know, is out there, you know, putting the quote-unquote positive spin on it.
Yeah. Now everybody's looking to do something so that they might mitigate their situation that they've already been doing in the past.
Yeah.
So, you know, God is more merciful than she is just, eh?
There has been a lot of major news stories just since 8/8 Lionsgate.
Mm-hmm.
So every day I'm wondering what to expect for tomorrow.
Also, what's the date today?
11.
Tomorrow is the anniversary of the Philadelphia experiment.
Right.
Although, let's see, this is, well, it's actually not the exact time. It's every 40 years, actually. So, I mean, and then there's a little indenture in between on the 20-year period in between. So 1943, 1983. And then
2003.
So the next one wouldn't be until 2023.
Mm-hmm.
And 2013 with Mother in our laps is next year.
Mm.
I mean, we're getting things really to trippy. It's very trippy to overfold some things that are not as we might think they are. Now, 2012 is this year. It's making our heads spin, don't you think?
Okay, so on December 21st, when that, you know, when that rift lines up, when the sun conjuncts with the Milky Way, then are we going to have to go down to Australia to be able to see that in the summer sky? Because it'll be, you know, Christmas here.
I would just say that it's going to be seen everywhere.
Let's put it this way. By that time, we have the option, don't we?
We do.
Where's my shuttlecraft, Ashtar?
Standing by.
On last night, Ashtar said all of that's available. It's ready to go.
Well, if we're ready to go and we want to do this, this Dr. Stephen Greer, maybe we'll find out more about when these shuttlecrafts show up. How about that? Can we play that song in between?
Yeah, we have some.
You got to go set it up, though.
Which one? The shaman?
The one with the unicorn.
Oh, I have to go back to that. Cause
yeah.
It's, I'm going to have to kind of mute out it because each one of these is going to start for a moment.
It's worth waiting for,
Rama. Oh, okay. I'm going to have to kind of do some fancy dancing here with you two. Because I don't want to.
Okay, we'll mute out, and Beth, you talk a little bit about something, and we'll be right back.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, everybody, I will thank everyone for the donations you've sent and remind everybody about the $5 button and the other donate button, which is on galacticroundtable.com. When you send these donations, it helps pay for our airtime and it keeps us on the air and it keeps our freedom of speech intact. And I thank everyone for all that you do to be a part of this family and help keep us on the air. I would also like to invite you to a conference call with the spirituality of the Aboriginal Moabite Nation. This is a call where you are going to pick up some wisdom you have never heard before. It is amazing. And we discontinued our Sunday calls about a month ago, and we are all going to these calls on Sunday morning with the Aboriginal Moabite Nation, and I strongly suggest you join us. It's a lot of fun. And these are conference calls, so you have to call in on Skype or your phone, and I'll give you the phone number. It's 1-712-432-9900. 0075. And their PIN code on Sunday mornings, starting at 11 a.m. Eastern and 8 a.m. Pacific, PIN code is 177867#. You can also call back and listen anytime, and I'll give you their callback number. You can access the last 4 weeks' calls at any time. That number is 1-712-432-1085. 712-432-1085, and the PIN code for that is the same, 177-867. And we hope you will join us tomorrow night on bbsradio.com for the Stargate Roundtable call. And if you're calling in that number for Thursday night for Stargate Roundtable with Mother Sekhmet, is 218-486-8700. And the PIN code for that is 878787#. And since Tar and Rama are muted out, I will say that I want to put a call out especially just for them. They could use a donation now. They are have their car at the mechanic, and Rama is driving around a loaner car, and the estimate from the mechanic is between $300 and $700, and they don't know what it'll be yet. And anybody who can reach out and help them with that to fix the car, it would be greatly appreciated. Just hit the donate button on galacticroundtable.com, and we'll take care of that. And thank you, family, for all of your donations. It's very much appreciated, and it helps us do our work. So, hi, how'd it go?
Okay.
We're ready. This is going to be a beautiful piece of music, and it's very powerful, and it's talking about the unicorn energies. And what's the name of this, Rama? Right there.
Zen Music Celta.
Medieval Fantasia. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Okay, just... I'm going to go to the hospital.
Rama said many of us looked like a lot of the beings in tan, and what they put out there in the front there, it was pretty outrageous.
It was all kinds of fairies and elves and
unicorns and dragons and
wizards.
I could answer you, but I'm floating.
Oh, okay.
Oh my gosh, that was beautiful.
Okay, we better get started. Time is of the essence here.
Thank you so much, you two.
Okay, Brahma, tell where you got this and what
the King of Swords sent this to me. And it's top secret military government intelligence and corporate witnesses to secret projects tell their true stories.
Which disclose the greatest covert program in world history. This exposure testimony.
Explosive testimony by actual government insiders proves that UFOs are real, that some are of extraterrestrial origin, and that super secret programs have energy and propulsion technologies that will enable humanity to begin a new civilization. A civilization without pollution, without poverty. A
civilization capable of traveling among the stars. Aho.
Here we go.
So let's stop.
Okay. Yeah, there we go.
So my own radar started picking up items going 3,000 to 4,000 miles an hour in this area.
But I do remember speeds in excess of 4,000 to 5,000 miles an hour.
And he said it was traveling 10,000 miles. Yes.
And they were going somewhere in the neighborhood of 11 to 14,000 miles an hour. They covered the distance from Columbus to Detroit in something like
equivalent of about 20,000 miles an hour.
That's not an infrequent occurrence out there. They have quite often.
There were probably 1,500 reported cases at that time.
I have over 3,000 cases now.
They estimated 100 yards from the left wing was this 100-foot disc.
And the strength of the signal was as strong as surface contact on the water on the aircraft carrier. This contact is huge.
The size of these objects around 100 meters or greater.
So it would go from 1 o'clock, 7 or 8 miles to 6, 7 o'clock, 7 or 8 miles inside of 4 or 5 seconds. You'd have to be moving pretty quickly.
And they could rise, go straight up. They could do that. It seemed like instantaneous.
Once they started moving, they went straight up, you know, for a while, and then they went zap. Then it just sort of disappeared. It didn't even realize. And left the atmosphere just was gone. It just took off into space.
It just left at high speed.
He said, you are never to speak of this again. As far as you're concerned, this never happened.
And you never saw this. I don't exist, and this situation never happened. I didn't want to look at it any longer than that because I felt that my life was in jeopardy.
So I was beaten, literally hitting in the ribs and pushed, and I was resisting, and I know Sergeant Vicenza was doing the same thing.
Measures have to be taken by agencies to terminate people who appear to be inconvenient or troublesome if you're lying too much.
Whatever activity is going on, to the extent that it is a clandestine group, a quasi-government group, a quasi-private group, it is without any type, as far as I can tell, of high-level government oversight. And that is a great concern.
A shadowy government with its own Air Force, its own Navy, its own fundraising mechanism, and the ability to pursue its own ideas of the national interest, free from all checks and balances, and free from the law itself.
We have contact with aliens, not originating from some foreign country, but from some other solar system. And I have been a party to that.
My name is Dr. Stephen Greer. I am the director of the Disclosure Project, which is a project of the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence. This is a project which we have been working on since 1992, and during this time, we have identified over 400 military, intelligence, and corporate witnesses to special access projects within the United States and elsewhere that deal with what the public has called UFOs, extraterrestrial intelligence, and advanced energy and propulsion systems. The purpose of this executive briefing is to put together some of this witness testimony. I want to emphasize that out of the over 400 witnesses whom we have identified, that we have interviewed to date on camera approximately 100. Of those, 120 hours of tape have been created of testimony from these witnesses. This executive summary can only contain a very small tip of the iceberg, less than 0.5% of the possible testimony which we have. But it will give you an idea of the extent of the knowledge of these men and women who have come forward heroically to tell the world, to tell our elected representatives and our scientists the truth about a subject which has been the subject of much ridicule, fantasy, and speculation for over 50 years. We will present three essential areas. Number one, what is the evidence? What is the testimony support? What is the case file support? And what do the government documents support? We will also then move on to something a little more difficult to explain, and that is the mechanism for secrecy. How does something of this import been kept secret from our representatives, and how has it been kept off the national and international radar screen effectively for over 50 years? Without understanding this, the evidence itself has no foundation. because any rational person will conclude that this couldn't be true or we would know about it, that the government leaks secrets like a sieve, and that indeed, if any of this were true, many of the people in society in high places in our government would know about it, when in fact they do not. So the secrecy around this issue, which has been extraordinary, must also be explained, and it will be. And the third component is the why. Why has it been a secret? What are the implications? I will remind you that a very conservative Republican two-term president and five-star general, Dwight Eisenhower, said that we should be careful of the excesses of the military-industrial complex. We now have learned, and you will hear testimony to this effect, that one of his chief concerns were that special access projects within the military and intelligence sector dealing with this subject were escaping the legal constitutional oversight of the American Congress and, indeed, of the American presidency. He stated this in January of 1961.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizen can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals.
Eisenhower's warning has really come full circle to this day, where we now see extraordinary funds being put into projects and being withheld from the American public, which if released could give us indeed an entirely new and sustainable civilization. These propulsion and energy systems used for peaceful purposes would enable the world to get off of its dependency of fossil fuels, oil, and the internal combustion engine, and have a truly non-polluting, sustainable civilization for thousands of years. The implications of this statement cannot be overstated. We are really talking about the ability of our civilization to move within a generation from a world which is facing environmental collapse, oil shortages, rolling blackouts in some of our states, and eventually growing world tension over a shrinking oil supply while demand skyrockets over the next 10 to 20 years. That grim scenario can easily be replaced by the declassification and peaceful application of these technologies. In addition to this, we have to consider what the risks are if we do nothing. The technologies, which are in compartmented secret programs that have been derived from studying extraterrestrial technologies as well as human innovations, which deal directly with energy generation and propulsion systems, are technologies which would enable the entire planet to begin to work in an integrated function and in a way that does not lead to greater and greater spiraling gaps between the rich and the poor. Beyond this, there is something of even greater concern. One of the witnesses whom you will hear from is a person who worked directly with Wernher von Braun, the very famous rocket scientist and space explorer, who warned on his deathbed that there were people planning to put weapons in space or to have space-defective weapon systems, which would be used in a hoax scenario from a threat, a hoax threat, that would be of extraterrestrial origin. There is no evidence that we are under any threat from any civilization from outside our solar system or within our solar system. However, there is a lot of evidence from this testimony that there are people who are deliberately trying to weaponize space under the guise of many situations which are really host scenarios. This is dangerous because if we are not alone in the universe, we cannot view space as our own private domain for Homo sapiens. We must view space as a frontier which must be shared peacefully with diverse life forms from throughout the universe. One of the points I would like to make also about these cases is that we must accept the testimony of all of these witnesses. The reason we must is that if we begin to dismiss dozens of military intelligence officers, corporate officials, as well as people within other walks of life who have professional credentials, their testimony on this issue, then it brings into question how we view witness testimony on many other things. If we use that same standard, every murder conviction in the United States should be overturned, which has been based on witness testimony. We would also, as Monsignor Balducci at the Vatican has pointed out to us, throw out the entire Bible, since that is almost totally based on human witness testimony of the people who wrote down the accounts during the times of Christ and his predecessors.
Can show that at a certain historical point lived a man named Jesus.
E questa dimostrazione si basa sulle testimonianze.
And in the end, this is based on human witness testimony.
Perché come facciamo a sapere che quel Vangelo di quello lì, quell'altro ancora?
But how do we know that this gospel is from that man and this gospel is from this man is true?
Sono le testimonianze che abbiamo.
And they are the testimony and the witnesses of those people.
Per cui, se si indebolisce il valore della testimonianza,
if you start taking apart and destroying the value of human witness testimony,
le conseguenze sono anche gravi, gravissime, specie per la religione cristiana.
The consequences are great, tremendous, especially for Christian religion.
I should emphasize that this human testimony is key. And in a sense, it's more important than any physical evidence because it is multiple, it is corroborating, and it cannot be tossed out in a cavalier fashion. We should be very careful that we do not ignore this testimony because the testimony of these men and women serves as a significant body of evidence with corroboration of photographs and other government documents. To introduce this part of the videotape, which deals specifically with pilots, radar cases, cases that involved telemetry and related technologies, I wish to emphasize that for decades, people who have been skeptical of this subject have claimed that if these objects were real, they would have been tracked on radar. We have no fewer than 20 witnesses from the Air Force, the Marines, the Navy, the Army, as well as civilian authorities in the United States and abroad, who are qualified air traffic controllers and pilots who have seen these objects on radar. Please note that these people absolutely will state that these have not been weather balloons, they have not been air inversions, they have not been swamp gas, they have been structured craft traveling at thousands of miles per hour, and suddenly stopping, hovering, or moving in a nonlinear fashion where these objects have been tracked and going from one spot to 500 miles away or further within one radar sweep. Commander Graham Bethune piloted his plane across the North Atlantic in 1951. The testimony you will hear is important and significant for a number of reasons. The object was very close. It was in 1951 and was tracked on radar moving at 1,800 miles per hour, a speed which no craft in the world could move at that time, at those speeds. Additionally, we've been able to locate his co-pilot as well as documents from the government of his official debriefing and report, which was made by the Navy and the military at that time.
The flight was normally about 10 hours, but that night we had a 60-knot wind, and it was a headwind. And about maybe 300 to 400 miles outside of Keflavik, out of Argentina, I saw something below the horizon on the water that looked like approaching a city at night. It was just kind of an ambient light, no definition whatsoever, but the same thing that you would see if you were approaching a large city at night. And all of a sudden we saw on the water a yellow halo that was very, very small, about 15 miles away. And it came up to 10,000 feet like that, at a fraction of a second. And I thought it was going to go right through us. And I disengaged the autopilot, pushing the nose over because I was going to go under it at the angle it was coming toward me. So what happened, the minute that I did that, it was up at our altitude, and I could see nothing outside of the cockpit but this craft. So I didn't know which way to go. And then all of a sudden I heard a racket. I didn't know what it was. And I said, Fred, what the hell was that? He looked around and he says, oh, he said everyone was ducking in the back of us and they collided there all the way on the deck back there scrambling on the deck. So when I looked back, it wasn't there. And he says, it's over here on the right-hand side. Now, it was about a mile or so away on the right-hand side. It kind of drifted forward maybe to a position maybe 5 miles away. And that's where it stayed with us for quite some time. This is when we could first see. It wasn't above our altitude, it was below our altitude, but it was still above the horizon where you could see the side of the craft, you could see the dome, and you could see the color around the perimeter of the craft. And then we knew that it was a friendly encounter. So, Doc, did you see what we saw? And he says, yeah. He says, look me straight in the eye. He says, yeah. He says, it was a flying saucer. So I went back forward, and I said, Dal, what are you doing? Don't tell anybody we saw anything or what is up as soon as we got on the ground. He said, it's too late. He said, I just called Gannery to control to see if they could track this by radar. So that's how it got out. So when we landed at Argentia, the Air Force was there, and they interrogated us. And the captain that did the interrogation did a real good job, but you could tell that this wasn't his first time that he'd ever interrogated anybody as far as the craft was there. When that question was asked, it was 300 feet that came into my mind. And when I got the report out of the archives in 1991, I'd never seen anybody else's report. Everyone had anywhere from 250 to 350 feet in diameter. Now, the velocity when it left us was estimated from between 1,000 miles an hour to 2,000 miles an hour. And when I looked at the report, Al Jones had estimated 1,800 miles an hour. Mine was 1,000, another one was 1,500 miles an hour, in that range. It turns out that the radar report, which I've never seen, said it was 1,800 miles an hour. So the other plane commander was sitting in the seat, took my seat, he had hit it right on the nose. And my boss, that's another thing. When he found the report in the archives in the Wright-Patterson Project Blue Book and talking to Colonel Watson, when he came back to me, he gave me the speed of 1,800 miles. I said, where did you find that out? And he said, well, it was a radar report that said that. The document that I found was the official document that the Air Force had put together, different sources that came to them. And it was originally filed, it was under Project Grudge. You can see in there written Project Grudge. But on the front page it says Project Twinkle. Now this is where they put a lot of ones that they had to get rid of somehow. It was Project Twinkle. So it was in Project Blue Book and Project Grudge and what other project, I don't know that was in.
Michael Smith was an air traffic controller with the Air Force, both in Oregon as well as subsequently in Michigan. At both these facilities, he witnessed UFOs tracked on radar moving at extraordinary speeds, and he also confirms that NORAD, the North American Air Defense Command, was fully apprised of these events, and in fact, one of these events in Michigan was engaged and steered B-52s returning to a base around the UFOs, which were at low altitude and were intersecting the flight path of these B-52s. Mm-hmm. This man has a very good career, and he has documented his placement at these facilities at the time that these events occurred. It establishes physical reality of these objects, and also, I should note, the fact that NORAD has been involved. This is of some significance, since we have learned that ex-President Clinton, had asked Webster Hubble, he was third in command at Justice, to look into the UFO issue. And when Webster Hubble and others made inquiries to NORAD, they denied any knowledge of these objects. This is serious because if these senior covert projects are lying to directed inquiries from the President of the United States, this constitutes a serious breach in our chain of command.
In spring of 1970, while I was stationed in Klamath Falls, Oregon, I came up to the radar site on an evening shift, and where there's normally two or three people in the radar room, there was quite a few, from the cooks to the maintenance, all kinds of people, and I asked what was going on, and they said that there was lots of UFO, and I immediately was stunned and asked if the Pentagon was notified, so we called the president there. And they said, no, they don't do that. It was stationary, wasn't moving at all, and it would slowly lower itself down until it got behind a mountain, so that you lost radar contact. It would stay down for about 15 minutes, and the next thing I knew, it was right back up there. And then it was up, you know, 80, 90,000 feet. And then the next sweep of the radar scope, it would be, you know, like 200 miles away. Stationary, completely stopped. And I said, well, we should call the news media or, call somebody. This is earth shaking news. And to me, and he said, no, I'm just calm down. NORAD knows about it. They called NORAD. And that's when the senior NCO pulled me to the side and said that NORAD knows about it. That's the only people we notify. We don't talk about this. We don't tell anybody about this. The people know. And we just watch, see what happens, and that's it. And I insisted, there has to be a report filed, something filed, you know. And they said, well, there is a report that you can file. It's about an inch thick. Mm. And the first two pages is about the sighting. The rest of it is basically a psychological profile of you, your family, you know, where your bloodlines, everything. So when the Air Force goes through it, they can discredit you completely by either saying that, you know, you was on drugs or your mother was a communist or anything to discredit you. And you'd never get a promotion. And I'd spend the next 3.5 years up the North Pole living in a tent checking the weather balloons. My second encounter was while I was stationed in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. It was in 1972. I was working alone that night when I got a phone call from the switchboard operator. He said he had the state police on the phone and wanted to talk to me. He was really frantic when he got on the phone and said that there's three UFOs over the North Tower Mackinac Bridge. So I immediately, you know, turned on the radar. When they asked if I had it on radar, I told them no. This is more of a programmed response, thinking back to the Klamath Falls, where you're told you don't talk about it, you don't write it down, you don't discuss it. And in the meantime, I called NORAD and told them, and they looked it up, and they said, oh, it's coming up, they're going up by 75, as you guessed, about 70, 80 miles an hour. Now, about halfway between St. Agnes and Sault Ste. Marie, there's Kinsale Air Force Base, which is a SAC base. They have B-52 bombers. They had two, apparently, that were on final approach, and that crosses I-75. And so, apparently, they diverted those two bombers because they didn't want, you know, if they have nuclear weapons or not, but they didn't want to take a chance on them meeting the UFOs about the same altitude across the island. So they diverted the two B-52s. It was a real eye-opener how deep the secrecy goes, how deep the cover-up is.
Enrique Kolbik is a senior air traffic controller at Mexico City International Airport. He testifies that up to the current day that these objects are tracked on radar at Mexico City International, moving at extraordinary speeds, and at times as many as 12 to 15 of them have been seen on radar at the same time. They are being visually seen by pilots and, in one case, photographed by civilians. He also states that one event involved 32 air traffic controllers controllers who saw the same event. These are trained professionals in a very busy international airport.
We have registered information about the 12 or 15 echoes at the same time. At the same time. A lot of pilots in reports when immediately happen an sighting. Do you have problems with his instruments of flight, precisely the electronic instruments? The pilots reports the size of these objects around 100 meters or greater. Our radar, at the same time, like in other radars in the world, doesn't detect light. Only objects, solid objects, fine. That is very important. We have two Mexican aircraft flying bound to the, coming from the north to the airport, flying to land. When one of them reports to have inside a small object of red color flying past it and passing beside him very, very fast, very. And the aircraft that was flying behind of the first reports to have another war inside, and they have a visual contact with these three different objects, different color. One's red and the other two white. Around 32 controllers have the same sighting, the same phenomenon inside. This kind of phenomenon appears sometimes 12 times at day, 12 times at the month, or at the week. This phenomenon, of course, doesn't count with the flight time. Nobody knows nothing about them. Appears when they want to appear.
Chuck Soros is a career Air Force military man who was at Edwards Air Force Base in 1961 when not one, but at least seven UFOs were over Edwards Air Force Base airspace, moving in extraordinary nonlinear fashion at enormous speeds, making right-hand turns and other maneuvers which no known aircraft could do. They were on radar, they were seen visually, and a special UFO officer scrambled and authorized a jet to intercept these objects. They were present between 1:30 a.m. and dawn, meaning that this event lasted for 5 or 6 hours. At about 1:30 or so in the morning, I noticed this real bright light to the east of my field. And it was kind of a light green, I was describing it, and it had a red light underneath it. And the red light wasn't actually a flashing light, it was kind of, I'd say, pulsating type, probably be a better description of it, red underneath. And it had a white, like, light on top that just glowed. And I had one of the detachment guys from the interceptor detachment that was on base there, had the captain down there, got him awake, got him to go out and look at it. Yeah, what is that, you know? And so we talked about it for a while. The RATCON people, that's the radar people on the base, they didn't have any aircraft in the area at the time. And so we got called down to the air defense people at Los Angeles Air Defense Sector. And the director down there decided, he got to call around his site. And at one point in time, they had at least four different radar sites that were getting radar returns on these things. And then all of a sudden, there's like three more objects. And they had similar characteristics as far as the lighting is concerned.
But these three stayed like together. They stayed like, I don't know if they were formation or what it was. But anyway, these three stayed together. And then they moved, they stayed there for a little bit, and then they moved down to the south of me and set their stationary wall. And then a little bit later on, there's three more appears, but these three are individual ones. And, so at this point I had like seven of them. This goes back and forth and back and forth for, I don't know, 2-3 hours. And, they finally decided to scramble an aircraft on it to go up and take a look at it. And, this was coordinated with the other, higher headquarters, and I think NORAD was involved nearby, well, about three different times. And he was able to, he'd say, contact. And that contact means he had contact with something in his, on his radar in the cockpit of the aircraft. But these objects, played around there for the remainder of the ship. And, they just disappeared into the atmosphere. I know a lot of things this was not. I know it was not a helicopter. I know it was not an airplane. I know it was not a balloon, a weather balloon or any other type of balloon. And I know it was no known aircraft, flying object that we know of today, or at that time. And it wasn't a laser show, it wasn't anything like that. But they could move, real fast. They could move from the east, they could be to the east of my field, and then in just a short period of time, they could be to the west. They could probably go 30 or 40 miles and, time you snap your fingers twice. I mean, just fast.
Colonel Charles Brown is a career Air Force officer, hero of World War II, and worked specifically in Project Grudge. This is a project which for many people didn't really exist, but it did. And his testimony not only proves its existence, but also he will state and you will hear how the project had definitive cases and evidence, cases that involved ground radar, air visual, and ground visual all at the same time in the same event. And as he said, it doesn't get any better than that.
Basically, because of my counterintelligence training and police work in an outfit called Office of Special Investigations. Since I had one of the few pilot-trained investigators, I ended up doing a lot of investigations of aircraft, unusual aircraft accidents, and was sabotaged, was suspected. And as a consequence, became acquainted with some outstanding scientists. And with the Air Technical Intelligence Center on a project called Grudge. At that time, Office of Special Investigations was a worldwide investigative unit in the Air Force, and given the responsibility of investigating what became known as unidentified flying objects. And my job was to hand carry these reports over to the technical center and coordinate them with the project officer, answer any questions from an investigative point that I could assist on. Some of the objects reported were tracked on radar. We had objects with four-way confirmation, ground visual, ground radar, airborne visual, airborne radar. And so far as I'm concerned, you don't get no better than that. I do remember speeds in excess of 4,000 to 5,000 miles an hour, which were far in excess of any known aircraft that we had or any of the enemies. There's no question, I've seen radar photographs of organized flights of unidentified objects, balls of light, if you will. And these were on radar, ground visual, ground radar, airborne visual, airborne radar. Now, the airborne visual, strangely enough, by the time they get a couple of fighters down there, those things apparently disappeared whenever they wanted to.
Mr. John Callahan is a senior FAA official. He was third or fourth down from the top of the FAA, underneath Admiral Ingram, at the time in 1986 that a major UFO event happened over Alaska. He will state that these objects were indeed on radar, that they were tracked moving in extraordinary nonlinear fashion and at speeds unattainable by any conventional propulsion system, and that the CIA had a meeting with the admiral who headed up the FAA and the science advisors for President Reagan. At the end of the briefing, took all the evidence and said, quote, "This meeting never happened. This event never happened, and we were never here." I wish to emphasize that John Callahan is one of those senior government officials that people are always asking about. Where are they? Why don't they come forward? Well, Mr. Callahan has come forward, and his testimony is definitive. In addition to John Callahan's testimony, we have an enormous amount of material which he had kept from his days at the FAA as a senior official there. These include the pilot's report of the encounter, the actual videotape of the radar tracings, the FAA report which was generated, transcripts of the air traffic controller talking to the Japan Airlines 747 captain, a military pilot, as well as subsequently a United Airlines pilot.
The way it started is it was a 747, the Japanese airline 747 was coming from the northwest going across the Alaskan territory. And he was at either 31, 33, or 35,000 feet. And it was, I want to say around 11 o'clock at night, but you can check the real times. He called and asked the controller if the controller had any traffic at his altitude. And the controller said, no, basically it was a midnight operation, they didn't have too much traffic. And he said, well, something like I have a target at my 11 o'clock or 1 o'clock position, about 8 miles. Now, in the 747, they have radar in the nose that picks up the weather outside there. So his radar is picking up a target. He sees this target with his eye, and the target, the way he described it, was a huge ball with lights running around it, and I think he said it was like four times as big as a 747. Well, when they read the reports that come through, the FAA has to protect themselves. You can't say you saw a target, even though this is what he said. So they made him change his report to position symbols, which makes it sound like it wasn't really a target. The military controller has what they call height-finding radar, and they have long-range radar and short-range radar. So if they don't catch it on one of their systems, they catch it on the other. And if you listen to the military man, at one time he said, I have it on the height radar, or my range radar, whatever you call it, which indicated that he had a target on his system. The Japanese pilot would say he's now 11 o'clock, he's now 1 o'clock, he's now 3 o'clock, he was bouncing around the sky here. And when he would say that, the military guy would cut in and say he's now at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, and he would confirm the position. So it would go from 1 o'clock, 7 or 8 miles to 6, 7 o'clock, 7 or 8 miles inside of 4 or 5 seconds. You have to be moving pretty quickly. When it was all done, and we went back to Washington the next day, the administrator had called down and wanted to know if he had a problem or not. And my boss had told him, well, we took a video of it, and it looks like there might have been something there. The administrator, which was Indian at the time, had no idea. He said, well, if you got that video with you, can you show me the video? And I said, yeah, and then he just plugged it in and played it. So we plugged it in for him. He started watching it, and after about 5 minutes, he told the staff to cancel my meeting with someone in 15 minutes. He says, first he said, I'll be late, and then next it was cancel, and then I'm going to be here till this is over. So he watched the whole thing just over half an hour. A few minutes later, the admiral called down and says, I set up a briefing tomorrow morning at 9 or 10 o'clock in the woods.
in the round room, bring all the stuff you have, bring everybody up there, and give them whatever they want, and we want to get out of it, just let them do whatever they want to do with it. They brought in three people from the FBI, three people from the CIA, and three people from Reagan's scientific study team, and I don't know who the rest of the people were. But they were all excited. When they got done, they actually swore all these other guys into the definitive place. We never had this meeting, and this was never recorded. He said this is the first time they ever had 30 minutes of radar data on a UFO, and they're all itching to get their hands into the data and to find out what it is and what really goes. And if they come out and told the American public that they ran into a UFO out there, it would cause panic across the country, so therefore you can't talk about it. And they're taking all this data. So I said, okay, take all the data. That's what you want. But they took only what we had there. They didn't ask me if there was anything else that I had. They said that they get all this data. And I said, fine. Now I had the original video that I took, and I had the pilot's report that came through, the first report, and I had the FAA's first report that was all downstairs on my table. They didn't ask for that, so I didn't give it to them. When they asked me what I thought, I told them that it looked like we had a UFO that was up there. The reason it wasn't on the FAA's tapes was because it was too large of an aircraft, and it was picked up as weather, so we wouldn't record it. That the pilot, the Japanese pilot, seen it. The Japanese pilot drew pictures of it. Eventually, they gave the Japanese pilot a hard time because of what he said. He was embarrassing his country. Military controllers said they seen it. Our FAA controllers said they seen it. Our FAA controllers, after a period of time, came back and said they really didn't see a target. They saw something else, which makes it sound like somebody is helping them fill out the reports. And therefore, that looks suspicious. My guess is, because of the way it was, it's not part of the military's operation anymore, that it was a UFO. But who do you tell that you were involved in a UFO incident without them looking at you like you ain't wrapped too tight?
Captain Kenju Terauchi was piloting a Boeing 747, Japan Airlines, from Paris, France to Tokyo over the polar route. And I interviewed him by phone. I'm the only civilian to interview this gentleman. After he and his crew had a major sighting over northern Alaska on their way to Anchorage to land for refueling. And as a result of his following the rules, which he did, making a report out, landing safely, delivering the cargo, being a good pilot, Japan Airlines asked him to not fly anymore. I have over 3,000 cases now. A certain proportion are certainly historical that I've not interviewed myself because some of them, they're so old I wasn't even alive, wasn't born yet. And many of them come from Project Blue Book, which is the official Air Force study of the subject. I would say in half of the cases at least, the phenomenon appears to approach the airplane, not the other way around. It's as if the aircraft is the focus of attention or curiosity, if I may use that word, of the phenomenon. That the pilot's flying along, minding his own business, and something comes up alongside one wing for 15 minutes, at cruise altitude, cruise speed, and then sometimes we'll flip over to the other wing, or stay right at the nose of the aircraft, and then do barrel rolls along the flight axis. Some very interesting maneuvers. I could say that at least in the non-black programs, we could not do what these objects were reported as doing. As a result of this review of my AirCap files, I found a number of cases back in the 60s, for instance, when the Air Force was still heavily involved in the subject, where they stepped in and interviewed, let's use the word, commercial pilots. Not just their own military pilots, but commercial pilots.
and ended the interview by saying, you're not to tell anybody about what you saw.
And I got off duty one night at midnight and went to bed, and I was called and told to come fix the radar. There was something wrong with it. And so when I got up to CIC and I asked him what the problem was, he said, well, we're tracking an aircraft here at 3,400 miles an hour. And I said, well, there is something wrong. So I took that radar offline, put the standby radar online, and went to work. And I started running all the tests, and everything was normal. So I, as a result of talking with them, I said, I can't find anything wrong with the radar. But there was clearly, they had clear plots, and they told me, it was an absolute stellar contact, because you usually get the size of the blips, usually do with either the size of the contact or the shape, something. And this was a blip that was better than a half inch across, which indicated a really large target. Or something very close. So I asked the officer if he was going to report it, and he said no. And I said, why not? And he said, well, he says, you've just told me there's nothing wrong with the radar. You've run all the checks you can run. There's nothing wrong with the radar. We know we tracked the thing. If we report it, then Colorado Springs is going to ask us what's wrong with our equipment. And you've already said there's nothing wrong, so you and I then have a problem. We both are in trouble. We got to come up with a story. And he says, I'm not going to report it. It was one contact. That was it. So one night I was on the plot board. This was maybe 3 or 4 months later. And here comes this contact. And the second blip, yeah, you could see that this thing was moving. It was moving like 3 or 4 inches on a 360-mile scale. And so sure enough, I plotted it, and it was 3,400 miles an hour. And, again, we didn't report it, but they said, you know, there's nothing wrong. This is our friend back. And away we went. And nobody thought anything about it. It was interesting. We didn't make a big deal out of it, but we sure like to know what that was. It happened at least 3 more times that I had radar operator friends that would tell me, well, we had another one of those fast ones last night.
I was flying a flight from San Francisco to Boston, DC-10, and we were about halfway between Buffalo and Albany at 37,000 feet. All of a sudden, the airplane started, it was on autopilot. The airplane started at about a 15-degree bank, turned to the left, and, of course, I looked out the window to, automatically, that's what you do when the airplane starts to turn. And I saw this brilliant light off. It's hard to tell exactly how far out it is, but it was very, very bright. And the first officer saw it. The second officer got out of his seat, took a look. About that time, the first officer hit the autopilot release button and went back to manual control. And as I was looking out the window, why this thing that we had vision, this thing that we saw, disappeared back towards the left of the airplane and to our rear at a very rapid rate.
This next section of the video, of this briefing tape, is regarding the Strategic Air Command and nuclear facilities. I wish to emphasize that the witnesses we have here, again, are from diverse services. They range from the Atomic Energy Commission to people who have been at Strategic Air Command facilities and at missile launch control facilities throughout the United States and Canada. These witnesses give unmistakably clear testimony about the fact that these extraterrestrial vehicles appear to be quite concerned with our weapons of mass destruction. And in fact, more than one of these witnesses has stated to me that they believe that these extraterrestrial vehicles were there because they were very concerned that we might blow ourselves up or that we might begin to go into space and be a threat, perhaps someday, to other civilizations. Professor Robert Jacobs was a respected professor at a major United States university who back in the 1960s was in the United States Air Force assigned to Vandenberg Air Force Base. His testimony is corroborated by letters and documents we have from his commanding officer, Lawrence Mansman. This man was present when a special photographic array photographed a testing of an intercontinental ballistic missile. And as it reached subspace, this missile was intercepted by one of these extraterrestrial vehicles and was rendered inert. This was on film. The film was confiscated. They were told to be quiet about it. And the specific frames dealing with the UFO encounter with this missile were cut out by intelligence officers and were never seen again. Again, this witness, who has tremendous credibility, has corroboration from a now-deceased senior military officer and subsequently a professor at Stanford University, Lawrence Mansman.
They counted down the missile. We heard engine ignition. Liftoff. We knew the missile was underway. And we were looking down south, southwest, and the missile popped up through the fog. It was just beautiful. And I hollered, "There it is." And our guys on our M45 tracking mount with 180-inch lenses on it got it. And the BU telescope swung over and got it. And we followed the thing. And sure enough, we could see all three stages of powered flight. It burned out and dropped away. And then, of course, to our naked eye, all we saw was a hot smoke trail going off into subspace as it headed off where it started, which was Aniwetok Island, Aniwetok Atoll. So we whoopied and shouted and heard the film wrap off in the BU telescope and figured, well, that was our first big deal and we got it. We sent the film back down to Vandenberg, and I don't know exactly how long it was after the event. It might have been a day or two. I was called into Major Mansman's office at the 1st Strategic Aerospace Division headquarters. And I walked into his office, and they had a screen and a 16-millimeter projector set up. There was a couch, and Major Mansman said, "Sit down." And there were two guys, as I recall, two guys in gray suits, civilian clothes, which was fairly unusual. Major Mansman said, "Watch this," and turned on the film projector. And I watched the screen, and there was the launch from the day or two before at Big City. It was quite exciting. Because of the length of the telescope, as the Atlas missile entered the frame, we could see the whole third stage, which has two rocket nozzles like this and one in the center, a gimbal one in the center, filling our frame from about 160 miles. That was pretty exciting optics. We watched that stage burn out. We watched the second stage burn out. We watched the third stage burn out. And into the frame came something else. It flew into the frame like this and shot a beam of light at the warhead, which is represented by my thumb here. Now, remember, all this stuff is flying at several thousand miles an hour. So this thing fires a beam of light at the warhead, hits it, and then this thing flies up like this. Meanwhile, we're all going like this, fires another beam of light, goes around like this, we're going like this, fires another beam of light, goes down like this, fires another beam of light, and then flies out the way it came in. And the warhead tumbled out of the outer space. The object, the points of light that we saw, the warhead and so forth, were traveling through subspace about 60 miles straight up. And they were going somewhere in the neighborhood of 11 to 14,000 miles an hour when this thing caught up to them, flew around them, went like this, and flew back out. Everything was going about 11 or 14,000 miles an hour that way. Now, when the lights came on, Major Mansman turned around and looked at me and said, "Were you guys screwing around up there?" And I said, "No, sir." And he said, "What was that?" And I said, "It looks to me like we got a UFO." Major Mansman, who was a very good reader of film, said that the feeling at the time was that it must have been extraterrestrial. That they assumed that the beam of light that struck the warhead, the dummy warhead, was some sort of plasma beam, because it looked like a plasma beam. He said what happened is this. They took the film and they spooled off the part that had the UFO on it, and they took a pair of scissors and cut it off. They put that on a separate reel, they put it in their briefcase, they handed Major Mansman back the rest of the film and said, here, I don't need to remind you, Major Mansman, for the severity of a security breach. We'll consider this incident closed.
Colonel Ross Dieterson had an illustrious career with the Air Force, which was followed by many years of service with the Atomic Energy Commission. During those years with the Atomic Energy Commission, he learned of specific incidents, not just one, but many, where these UFOs were over weapon storage areas, nuclear manufacturing facilities, as well as intercontinental ballistic missile sites. He also testifies that he learned specifically that we were planning to demonstrate our power to the Soviets by placing a nuclear missile on the moon and exploding it there, and that this missile was intercepted by extraterrestrial vehicles as it left Earth's atmosphere. This man has had a tremendous career, and we have documentation of his assignment not only in the Air Force, but at the Atomic Energy Commission. He is an elderly gentleman who is coming forward because he thinks this should be known by the world.
It was July of 1952. And, of course, during that period of time, I made a lot of contacts. I was a staff officer for the military liaison committee between the chairman of the AEC and the Secretary of Defense. And so I became acquainted with not only the Army, Navy, and Air Force, but civilian agencies, the CIA, the National Security Agency, and other contacts which I developed. During that period of time, one of my functions was to accompany a security team which visited all of the nuclear facilities to check on the security weapons. And we were getting reports of visits by UFOs over the storage facilities and even some of the manufacturing facilities. Later, I was assigned to the Sandia Corporation as a military liaison, and I was involved in establishing a quality assurance program for the manufacture and the quality and the maintenance of the nuclear weapons. So we had to visit all the manufacturing facilities, such as Rocky Flats and the Pantex facility, which assembled the nuclear and non-nuclear components of the weapons. And so there again, we observed the UFOs were very much interested in the facilities that we were visiting. Almost all those cases where the UFOs became identified, at least on a radar or by reports, why they would try to scramble aircraft to intercept them. It was a very aggressive, you might say, response from our own government. Then I was assigned to the Unified Pacific Command under Admiral Felk during the 60s, and I was the officer in charge of the alternate command post involved in nuclear weapon operation planning. And during this period of time, I also learned of a number of incidents which happened. A couple of nuclear weapons sent into space were destroyed by the extraterrestrials. Our government sent a nuclear weapon for explosion on the moon's surface. It was tended to, as I understand it, to assess some scientific data and reaction and so forth. The idea of any explosion in space by any Earth government was not acceptable to the extraterrestrials, and that has been demonstrated over and over. And then further on, I finally retired from the Air Force and joined the Boeing Company, where I was assigned to the Minuteman program, where I was responsible for the configuration accounting of all the nuclear fleet of Minuteman 1, 2, and 3. And during that period of time, I also learned about incidents involving nuclear weapons. The one incident, for example, was they actually photographed the UFO following the missile as it climbed into space and shining a beam on it, which neutralized the missile. And this was recorded. It was all hushed up. We split up the team that observed it, but of course eventually the news came out and it was later published and confirmed it.
Lieutenant Colonel Arnie Arneson was present at a Strategic Air Command facility when one of these objects on radar was seen. He also learned that the intercontinental ballistic missiles were rendered inert during this and a related encounter. His testimony is corroborated by another military official, Robert Salas, who was present also at Malmstrom Air Force Base during an extraordinary event. The testimony of these two men, as well as the supporting documentation, establishes the reality of these objects and that they did have a deep concern with our nuclear facilities. In addition, they demonstrated that if necessary, they could render these intercontinental ballistic missiles inert.
I was a crypto officer for the entire Ramstein Air Base. I was a top secret control officer. And in that capacity, I happened to see a classified message go through my comm center, which said that a UFO has crashed on the island of Spitsbergen in Norway, and a team of scientists are coming to investigate it. I do not recall where the message came from, where it was going to, because in that capacity, we were oftentimes told, what you see here, leave here. But I can recall seeing that. The next thing that comes to mind is one that took place in 1967. I was in charge of the communications center at 28th Air Division at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana. I was, again, the top secret control officer there. I dispatched all the nuclear authenticator to the SAC missile crews and whatnot, so I had a very good top secret background to, you know, to go on. One day, I happened to see a message that came through my communication center. There again, I cannot quote the date, where it came from, where it was going to, but I do recall reading it and saying that basically that a UFO was seen near missile silo numbers, I can't recall, but it was hovering there. And it said that the crew going on duty and the crew coming off duty all saw the UFO just hovering in midair. It was a metallic circular object. And from what I understand, the missiles were all shipped up. They were in the missile silos and they were being, I don't know what SAC does as far as activating the missile is concerned, but it's basically on a standby mode so it can be launched. But when they say it went down, they mean it went dead. And something turned those missiles off. And so they could not be put in a mode of launching.
The event, the incident, I guess I call it, is happened on the morning of March 16th, 1967. As I recall, it was early in the morning, and I received a call from my topside security guard, and he said that he and some of the guards had been observing some strange lights flying around the site. It wasn't more than, within a few minutes, maybe a half hour later. He calls back, and this time he's very frightened. I can tell by the tone of his voice, he's very shook up. And says, "Sir, there's a glowing red object hovering right outside the front gate." He said, "I'm looking at it right now. It's a glowing red object. I've got all the men out here with their weapons drawn." And of course, he was all shook up while he was telling me this. He was very excited. I immediately went over to my commander, who was taking a nap. We had a little cot down there. He's in a rest period. And I was telling him about the telephone call we just received. And as I was relating this to him, our missiles started shutting down one by one. There were approximately anywhere from 6 to 8 that went down, but they went down in rapid succession, which again is an extremely rare And in the meantime, I called upstairs to find out what the status was of this object. The guard said, well, the object has left. It just left at high speed. Echo Flight is another squadron about, I'd say, 50, 60 miles away from our location. But they had the same sort of thing happen. They had UFOs that were hovering, not the launch control facility, but the actual launch facilities where the missiles are actually located. They had some maintenance and security people out there at the time. And they were observed, the UFOs were observed by these people out at those sites. Now they lost all 10 of their weapons. So that morning, we lost anywhere from, 16 to 18 ICBMs. At the same time, UFOs were in the area and were observed by airmen. This incident was of extreme concern to SAC headquarters because they couldn't explain it. Nobody could explain what happened. There's another incident that happened just within a week of this, week after, where there were radar reports and quite a few more witnesses.
So we all turn around, and they're sitting about, I'd say, half a mile from the tower,
and
about 3,000 feet. Was three silver UFOs, sitting in the farm. Was two here and one covering the center. Once they started moving, they went straight up, for a while, and then they went zap. And they was off our scope, and our scope would go out to 260 miles. And so that you calculate that, and that's pretty fast. I called headquarters, and the guy on the phone, and he says, I said, okay, we got a contact. And he says, you mean SAC is running a mission against you? And I said, not SAC. Not SAC. What? I says, Cosmos. Wait a minute. He says, scramble your phone. So there's a switch you can throw that scrambles everything in mine. And I said, okay, my phone's scrambled. Yours scrambled. Mine's scrambled. You taking pictures? Taking pictures. Taking radar pictures? Taking radar pictures? Taking real pictures. He says, okay. Don't say another word. He says, I will send a courier up there. You'll get there in about 6 hours. You turn everything over to him. We are never officially ever noted for those pictures, that they ever received those pictures. It was just went secret. It went black like it never happened.
And what we saw were three very bright but independent lights. I mean, three separate lights. We assumed they were independent. And they were in a perfect, equilateral, a perfect triangle. The curious thing about this formation of lights that caused us to watch it for an extended period of time, 10 or 15 minutes we watched it, was that first it was silent. Second, it was moving slowly, but in a perfectly constant altitude, perfectly constant velocity, and perfectly constant direction from north to south. When I arrived at the command post the next morning at about 6:30 in the morning, it was unusually active and unusually well-staffed. In fact, it was a beehive of activity, and there were people that who had obviously been there most of the night, and it seems that these lights did position themselves over the alert force of B-52s, over the alert pad, where there were a specified number of B-52s configured for their wartime mission. And these lights were very interested in that wartime configuration, it would appear. And as sorties returned, I was told by those who had been there overnight, they were asked to close and try to identify, close with and try to identify these lights. And this included B-52s, KC-135s, and even some of the F-106 interceptors that had been out during their particular training missions as well. And the pattern was the same each time an aircraft would approach. The lights would depart in ways that defied any aerodynamic knowledge that anybody there had. Just rapid accelerations, rapid changes in direction, including vertical, and just doing things that something that is flying by the rules of aerodynamics that we understand would not have been at all possible. This whole event took from beginning to end, probably in the range of 6 and perhaps more hours. And in retrospect, it is curious how quickly that subject just was dropped. It just wasn't discussed.
When I was the commander of a radar squadron up in Maine at Castle Air Force Station, Maine, we were right next door to Warren Air Force Base, which is where they launched the B-52s and the KC tankers and things like that. I had a lot of security friends over there at Warren who told me about, and I have no first-hand knowledge of it, but they also had seen UFOs hovering near the nuclear weapons storage area on Warren Air Force Base. And a lot of my technicians that work for me as a communication electronics officer, they would tell stories about things going across the radar screens at fantastic speeds, you know, but they were not, I think, go that fast.
I was on a mid-watch during my second land cruise, and it was about sometime between midnight and 2 o'clock. And I had a contact come on the radar, so I knew the difference between surface search radar and air search radar. There's differences in polarity of the radio signal and things like this, and how the waves come back, all this stuff, kind of stuff, you know, active and passive, electronic countermeasures. So I know the difference between a flock of geese or, you know, wave returns or false echoes. In fact, this was the first thing that challenged me to check it out in ECM as to whether or not the contact I had in the scope was genuine. Because this was between 65,000 feet and above, and the strength of the signal was as strong as a surface contact on the water of an aircraft carrier. This contact was huge. It was got my attention. And the attention of others that were on watch. There were 4 enlisted on watch and 2 officers at the time. And so anyway, in this particular case, it was showing up on ice finding equipment and it was showing up on radar equipment. And then it began to move fairly slowly at first and then very quickly. The CO came in and he wanted to know what the heck was going on here, and they looked at it and asked what the hell was that, you know, and it got the attention of the captain at that time. It was Captain Clark. Was my captain. My commander was Commander Gibson at the time. And there was only one person on watch in ECM. And before I knew it, in a matter of 15 minutes, the ship was being turned and 2 Phantom 2s were being prepared for launch. The Phantom 2s went to afterburners, and they were about 100 miles or so away from this contact and turned on the conical scan radar lock on, and it winked out. Just disappeared. After they landed, 5, 35 minutes later, and everybody settled down, this thing wings back on and it's about 12 miles from the ship, hovering about 30,000 feet. And in any event, they went out and the lookouts couldn't see anything. Nobody could see anything. But it was there on our radar scope. It was not a false signal. And my CO told me, Jordan, this, you know, what have you got in the law? This never happened. And I wasn't the only one there on watch that night. So anybody who was there at that time knows what I'm talking about and knows that it's the truth. But less than a dozen people knew what went on that night. That ship had 5,000 men on it. There were documents that I had seen that referred to the Roosevelt having several instances of UFO flyovers, and particularly after they took on board nuclear weapons. And I was on board when they did take those on for the first time.
This particular night, I took the message off the teletype and followed it because it was not to us, and I turned around to check the teletypes again and saw something I had never seen before, and that was that all 8 teletypes were just typing complete garbage, totally incoherent. So I immediately called facilities control and the intercom to inform them that my broadcasts were out, and they informed me that they were busy because all communications had just gone out ship-wide. The propulsion system still worked. We could maintain the speed and course and steer, but from all the stories that I heard, anything that was electronic in nature ceased to operate. A few seconds later, we heard we had an intercom and a pneumatic tube system that went between the communications room to the signal bridge, which was located at the very top of the island structure of the carrier. And we heard a voice come on, very excited, yelling that God was here, it was the end of the world. And we looked at each other and thought, well, that's strange, what's going on there? Another few seconds went by, and another voice came on, more control. This person said that there's something over the ship, is what he said, there's something over the ship. Well, I looked at a friend of mine, a shipmate, and he looked at me, and we decided to go have a look. We observed a large glowing sphere over the island structure of the ship, over the ship. It was hard to decide what size this thing was, because there was no perspective. It was late in the evening, the sun had gone down, it was twilight. But it looked huge. I would say anywhere from 300 or 400 feet to a quarter of a mile, depending on how high it was. It glowed in a pulsating manner between a yellowish and an orangish color. I couldn't see any details other than a glowing spherical object. Unfortunately, I only got to observe this object for less than 30 seconds because by the time we got out there and started looking at it, general quarters went off on the ship battle stations, and we had to go back to our watch station, which was our battle stations. A few days later, the commanding officer and the executive officer came on the closed circuit television system that we had on board. It was the only way they could address the crew of 5,000. He looked at the camera, and I'll never forget this. He looked at the camera and he said, I would like to remind the crew that certain events that take place on board a naval major naval combatant vessel are considered classified and should not be discussed with anyone without any to know. Some men arrived on the ship when we returned to Norfolk to interview some people in suits. Lord knows where they came from, what agency they were from. I'm convinced that there's something to it. I'm convinced that the government, somebody in the government knows a lot more than we know.
Merle Shane McDowell worked for the United States Navy in 1981 and had a top secret SCI, Special Compartmented Intelligence clearance, with zebra stripes. What this means is that he was one of a few people cleared to be in the command center at the Atlantic Command facility near Norfolk, Virginia, during very critical events, including thermonuclear war. Merle Shane McDowell's testimony establishes that an object came in off the northern North American coast, was tracked on 4 or 5 radar stations, that jets were scrambled from multiple facilities to intercept and to attempt to force down this object which came from space. You will also testify that this object moved in one radar sweep from off the northern coast of North America to off the coast of Norfolk, Virginia, and then down to off the coast of Jacksonville, Florida. Admiral Harry Train, who was Commander-in-Chief, Atlantic Command, was present during this event, witnessed it, and was involved in scrambling jets to intercept and to attempt to force down this object.
I was granted, after a six-month wait, a top secret special compartment intelligence clearance, with a zebra stripe identification badge, which permitted access to all facilities on the base at all times. It's the highest level of alert that the Navy has or had at that time for dealing with, generally dealing with global nuclear threats. When you set a condition zebra, whether it's a drill or not, people who are not authorized to be there who do not have a zebra access badge, it's a zebra stripe badge on your clearance badge, they have to leave the command facility, and we have Marines stationed outside the building there, in the building as well as outside, that were under orders to shoot any unauthorized personnel that remained in the command center. They would announce it beforehand, this is a drill, set condition zebra. And unauthorized personnel would be escorted out of the command center if they didn't already know that they had to leave. But they turned the lock down this time and they didn't say this is a drill. There's a door right here. And this guy, the Marine comes in and wants to know what's going on. Is this a drill or so forth? And they've got orders to start shooting people. And I know because I actually got the junior OOD's attention and said, hey, you guys need to tell this guy something. He's ready to start shooting people, you know, because they haven't told him to stand down yet, and which he did. And I remember, you know, wanting to just get the hell out of there. We had contact with an unidentified flying object that had entered our airspace. And at that point, when Admiral Train found out that it wasn't the Soviets, and that he wanted to know whether the Soviets responding to this threat also. That was the end moment that he gave authorization to put two planes up to go see what this thing was. Pilots, you could hear the pilot's live voice transmission being piped into the command center, visual confirmation of the object, description of the objects. Pilots were able to close a couple of times and be able to see that the object was not an aircraft. That we were familiar with was nothing that we had, was nothing the Soviets had, and that was determined very quickly. This thing absolutely had complete control of the situation, and it could just be wherever it wanted to be just in a matter of seconds. 1 minute we're, you know, closing on it, you know, off the coast of Maine, the next minute it's in Norfolk, headed south towards Florida. As Admiral Train was doing, he was scrambling, authorizing planes up, just left and right, up and down the whole eastern seaboard. It headed out toward, it was over the Atlantic, towards the Azores. I do remember them saying that it had pulled up at a 66 degree angle when it approached, as it approached the Azores, like this, and it just pulled up at a 66 degree angle without slowing down or anything, and left the atmosphere just was gone. He just took off into space and was gone, and just like that. The only descriptions that I recall that the pilots actually made were that they could not find any markings on the aircraft. They could not find any visible signs that the thing had wings, a tail, windows, a cockpit, or anything like that, or any markings from any country. They did get close enough to get some photographs taken that were later brought over to the command center. Wasn't the photograph, I could remember the shape, but I would have said would have been, I would say a cylinder. I would say a cylinder because it was abrupt. It had abrupt ends that didn't take, the ends didn't taper down like most airplanes.
When our one of the B-52s, which were armed with nuclear weapons, there appeared a bluish haze, almost in the form of a boomerang or a wing shape. And in this haze, there was a glittery light. We had no idea what this was. And we do know that the SAC teams were called to ready, so they came out of the plane. But prior to that, this just hovered over the plane for a short period of time, and this vanished. It wasn't as if you actually saw it fly away. It was like in a whisk, it was gone. This was something that actually showed up on radar, and the perimeter guard saw it, and the other people on the other post, because there's one person per B-52 bomber.
Astronaut Gordon Cooper is one of the heroes of our country. He witnessed not only a daytime UFO event in Germany, but in addition, while working and connected to the U-2 project at Edwards Air Force Base, his team had one of these objects land in broad daylight at Edwards Air Force Base. It was filmed. He oversaw this film being developed and sent to the Pentagon under special circumstances. Again, this is a hero of our country, astronaut Gordon Cooper, stating that one of these objects, UFO, landed in the 50s at Edwards Air Force Base, and it was filmed. He saw the film, and it was sent back to the Pentagon. And his testimony cannot be contradicted because of the credibility that this great man has.
We're flying in Germany, and we were flying F-86s. And they would come over and do the same maneuvers that we make, except they weren't flying well on the North Sea. And you just can't do that in a fighter, conventional fighter. I was having some cameramen film the installation of a precision landing cell that we were putting in right on the head of the dry lake. And the saucer flew right over and put down three little gear and landed out on the dry lake bed. And they went out to, picked up their cameras and moved on out toward him filming. And he left it off, put the gear back in the well, and climbed down at a very high rate of speed and disappeared. And so while I was going through all the regulation books and finding out the number to call and watching it and reporting it, I had them go over and develop the film. By the time they got back to the developed film, I was on the higher and higher and higher level officer talking to me. Finally, with the colonel telling me to, when the film arrived at my desk, to put it in the carrier pass, there would be a courier there at my office by that time already, and they'd arrange for him to fly in our base airplane back to Washington with his film. But I had a chance to hold it up to the window and look at it. It was certainly a good film. I think they're for real. I think eventually we'll find out that there's a regular travel down this earth from other planets.
Carl Wolf worked for the military and was at Langley Air Force Base as an Air Force technician during the 1960s. While there, and in his capacity working on some devices in a very secret area of Langley, he was shown by another technician photographs taken by the lunar orbiter prior to the lunar landing of structures on the moon that were specific, artificial, and constructed of stone and other materials. Some of them were very large. Anti-states are unmistakable evidence that someone had been on the moon before we landed in 1969 and that there are artificial structures on the moon.
My boss came to me. I was working in a color lab at that time. I was a technician, photographic technician. I was asked to go over to this facility on Langley Air Force Base where the NSA was bringing in the information from the lunar orbiter. And so I packed up some tools. I went over. I went into the facility. A couple of officers took me into this hangar. It was a very large hangar. So they took me into this laboratory. I took a look at the equipment. There was an airman second class in there. I was an airman second class as well. He turned the equipment on and put it through its paces. It didn't do what it was supposed to do. I saw what was going on with it. And I said to him, you know, we'll have to take this thing out of the lab if we're going to work on it. We can't work in here in the darkroom environment. So everyone left the facility, left the darkroom, except this airman second class and myself, and we're in waiting for someone to come to remove this piece of equipment. And at the time, I didn't know what the real purpose of this dark room and this operation and this facility was. I thought this was where they were bringing the data in and then releasing the images to the public. They were doing 35 millimeter strips of film at that time, which were then assembled into 18.5 by 11 inch mosaics, they were called. There was a digital signature and a grayscale on every 35 millimeter strip. And those strips were from successive passes around the moon. So he was showing me how all this worked, and we walked over to one side of the lab, and he said, by the way, we've discovered a base on the back side of the moon. And I said, who? What do you mean, who? He said, yes, we've discovered a base on the back side of the moon. And at that point, I became frightened, and I was a little terrified, thinking to myself that anybody walks in the room now, I know we're in jeopardy, we're in trouble, because he should be giving me this information. And then he pulled out one of these mosaics and showed this base, which had geometric shapes. There were towers, there were spherical buildings, there were very tall towers and things that looked somewhat like radar dishes, but they were large structures. If I compare it to what I'm seeing now, because I do have photographs that have artifacts in them that are similar to what I saw, they're massive. Some of the structures are, you know, a half a mile in size. So they're huge structures. Some of the buildings seem to have very reflective surfaces on them. A couple of structures that I saw reminded me of cooling towers at power generating plants. They had that sort of shape. Some of them were just very, very straight and tall with a flat top. Some of them were round. Some of them looked like a Quonset hut, you know, with a domed kind of like a greenhouse. The particular shot that I saw, there were several clustered together over a landscape, a fairly large landscape. I didn't want to look at it any longer than that because I felt that my life was in jeopardy. Do you understand what I'm saying? I would love to have looked at it longer. I would have loved to have gotten. I would love to have, you know, said more about it and discussed it more. But I knew I couldn't. And I knew that the young fellow who was sharing this was really, really overstepping his bounds at that point.
Should we play the rest?
Well, yeah. We don't have enough time to finish it tonight.
No.
But I think that's... Holy cow, everybody.
Oh, my God.
Are we... Is everybody here?
I'm here. It's exciting.
It is. This is the beginning of full disclosure, everybody.
That's right.
You know, I thought we were going to have full disclosure way back there in May of what when they had all those 50 people come forward and speak. Years ago was that, and now it's happening all over again.
Yeah.
Starting all over again. It's really going to be easy now. Not going to be rough. It's tough in the sense of facing the music, yet it's been even tougher saying, come on, where are we going to get this out in the open? Now we got it. It's coming now.
The really important thing right now is that we honor and namaste the ones who came and taught us these lessons, and we release them and we say, I'm sorry. Thank you. Please forgive me. I love you. And we send them on their way because Mother says time is up.
Yeah.
It is up. It's really up. Woo, what's all the singing there?
That's you, my friend.
Mm. Oh.
Yes, you're reverbing once in a while. It must be your good energy.
Yeah, well, it's all of our sound of one hand clapping. I mean, it's bursting forward now out of the silence. How about that one, sound of silence?
Well, I prefer Let's Dance. Do you have a song, Rama?
Yeah.
Oh, Let's Dance. Which one is that?
Well, whichever one he chose. We need a happy song now. It's time to dance. Oh.
Yeah, come on.
Oh, okay. Oh, my. I got something here. It's kind of interesting. Celtic solstice music.
You think that's going to be dancing?
I think so.
Okay, let's go.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for all your donations. Very much appreciated now.
Thank you for all you do and for all that we do.
Okay, ready?
Ready. Thank you.
Music, everybody. Did you dance? Oh my goodness, that's quite a sound, isn't it?
Good Irish music.
Okay, everyone. I think it's time to see you on the bridge.
Yes.
And in the heart of all that is. Are you sure we're done with one more? We got a few more minutes. How about something that everybody loves? That everybody knows, something that we know.